The $3.6 billion that Bank of America, in essence, gave to the Merrill Lynch employees in bonuses, he says he doesn't know where it went or who gave the authority. So now when they go to the Merrill Lynch CEO, the former CEO of Merrill Lynch, John Thain, he says the same thing. Oh, it wasn't me. It wasn't me. No. Bank of America gave the bonus. And then Bank of America says, it wasn't us. Merrill Lynch gave the bonus. So nobody had any authority, but somehow $3.6 billion flew out of the door. The interests of these executives are not the interests of the banks. They don't really give a damn if Merrill Lynch exists.
This week in Radical History for the week starting March 9th.
Yo, check this out, man.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes.
And this week in Radical History from March 9th, 1865, showing that the U.S. is just fine with multitasking, U.S. military forces land at Veracruz, Mexico, and Panama, all to protect American interest simultaneously. Also on March 9th, 1879, anarchist Carlos Tresca lives. Unlike some of the more famous anarchists of their times like Berkman and Goldman, Tresca was early about being leery of the communist Bolshevik takeover of Russia and fought hard against the fascist rise in Italy, until forced to leave for America. Italy would put pressure on the U.S. to deport Tresca back, and though the FBI would gather over 1,300 pages of information on Tresca, he is able to stay ahead of the game until gunned down most likely by a mafia person in 1943. Also on this date in 1892, Ida B. Wells, friend and neighbor Tom Most, is lynched, which would prompt her anti-lynching campaign, which is followed by the destruction of her printing press and her move from Memphis to New York. In response to the alarming increase of lynching of African Americans, she compiled and published in 1895 a statistical study of lynching called A Red Record. Wells Barnett was also an integral part of the early civil rights movement, participating as secretary of the National Afro-American Council that led to the formation of the NAACP. Ida B. Wells.
And on this day in 1945, a fleet of specially modified U.S. bomber planes embarked on a mission to firebomb civilian targets in Tokyo, Japan. The actual bombing began the following day as more than 2,000 tons of incendiary explosives were dropped on houses, shops, and buildings, killing between 80 and 130,000 non-combatant Japanese civilians in the largest firestorm ever recorded. The firebombing of Tokyo was a decisive factor in forcing the Japanese surrender, which was already imminent when the U.S. dropped atomic bombs on the civilian centers of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Historians argue today over whether either act was justified, but many Japanese and Americans alike regard both bombings as crimes against humanity for which the U.S. has never atoned. And those are just some of the events in world history that took place on this day, March 9th. This Day in History is a production of the Neighborhood Network in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis.
Lastly, from March 9th, 1969, the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, which featured controversial music acts such as The Beatles, The Who, Jefferson Airplane, The Doors, and blacklisted Pete Seeger, is canceled by CBS Television. This is in the wake of the controversy over the on-air censorship of guest star Joan Baez. CBS Television canceled the show after they let Joan Baez dedicate a song to her husband David, who was convicted of draft resistance against the Vietnam War. This week in Radical History for March 10th.
The Russian Revolution began on this day in 1917, or at least the seminal events that led to the overthrowing of the Russian monarch or czar, when women workers in textile factories in Petrograd walked off their jobs and marched in the streets demanding bread and provisions, which were in short supply on account of the Russian participation in World War I. Socialists, including the Bolshevik Party of one Vladimir Lenin, urged the broadening of the marchers' demands to include an end to the war and the replacement of the monarchy with a democratically elected form of government. Tsar Nicholas responded by ordering his generals to suppress the marches with violence. The marchers, in turn, became more determined and succeeded in ousting the Tsar, whereupon a provisional government was established that represented the Russian aristocracy. And on this day in 1970, the trial of 30 U.S. soldiers responsible for the My Lai massacre during the Vietnam War commenced. The massacre, in which an Army battalion systematically raped, butchered, and burned between 300 and 500 unarmed Vietnamese civilians under orders from Lieutenant Calley. Of the defendants, only Calley was convicted, himself of killing 22 civilians, a crime for which he served a total of 3 years in prison. And those are just some of the events in world history that took place on this day, March 10th.
This week in radical history, from March 11th, 1833, U.S. invades Nicaragua to protect blank interests. Anyone? Anyone?
Bueller, Bueller, anyone, anyone, Bueller.
On this day, March 11th, in 1917, the British Army conquered the Mesopotamian capital city of Baghdad from the Turks, dealing a decisive blow to the Ottoman Empire. The Turks had ruled over the region with some degree of brutality, and although the British general Sir Frederick Stanley Maude, who commanded the British troops there, proclaimed on this day that the British had arrived, quote, not as conquerors but as liberators, unquote, the preceding period of British colonial rule was even bloodier. Within a few years, several nationalist revolts were suppressed and tens of thousands of citizens were killed. The British even used poison gas against entire villages during that period. In 2001, a group of leaders of the Zapatista Rebellion in southern Mexico arrived at the Zocalo, or Central Square, in Mexico City amid the triumphal cheers of more than 10,000 people, culminating the end of a 15-day march from Chiapas to call attention to the systematic denial of civil rights for the region's indigenous communities by the Mexican government. The Zapatistas had initially begun their rebellion as a protest over the North American Free Trade Agreement, a treaty with the United States, which has had a disastrous impact on Mexico's rural economies. People, the time has
come. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, March 12th in 1864, General Carleton, commander of the Department of New Mexico, wrote an insightful letter to a fellow general regarding the recent surrender of the Navajo people. The letter proclaimed, quote, they found it was their destiny, too, as it had been that of tribe after tribe, to give way to the insatiable progress of our race. They threw down their arms and have come to us with confidence in our magnanimity. Talk about a perfect example of white supremacy and sense of entitlement. And they teach us that manifest destiny was a noble concept. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
More bad news on March 12, 1992 in Guatemala. Efren Bamaca, husband of U.S. activist Jennifer Harvey, is seized by the military in the employ of the CIA. He is later tortured and killed. This week in radical history for March 13th, only have two items. 1864, first contingent of 1,430 Navajo reach Fort Sumter, New Mexico, during the Long Walk of the Navajo, a 400-mile forced march in which thousands would die. Also in spring of 1932 in this date, hunger marches take place throughout the country, and bonus marchers are expelled from Washington, D.C. The bonus marchers were World War I vets denied their bonuses for fighting all those years earlier. The current military would rush the encampment of the World War I vets with bayonets and tanks, showing once again how disposable our vets are once they are all used up. People, the time has
come. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, March 14th in 1794, Eli Whitney patented the cotton gin. The cotton gin, a machine that quickly separated cotton from the seeds inside, greatly sped up cotton production and increased demand for the plant. As a result, the African slave trade in America, which had been losing popularity, saw a great resurgence and the slave population increased by millions. Although Whitney is given credit for the invention of the cotton gin, there is evidence that the true inventor was actually a slave. Slaves who were not even considered full human beings had no rights to patents. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away. Say it.
Also on March 14, 1912, IWW workers, industrial workers of the world, agree to terms granting wage increases as 10,000 strikers gather and vote, successfully ending the Bread and Roses Lawrence textile strike. The strike was predicated on wage cuts and horrendous working conditions in Lawrence. Martial law had been declared by the city-owned big business. Workers were arrested, some sent to jail for a year. A young Syrian striker, John Ramey, was bayoneted to death and a pregnant woman beat so badly by police that she gave birth to a dead baby as the strike dragged on. But the workers refused to give in, and when the raises were won, the strikers insisted that the largest increase go to the lowest paid amongst them. This is also the end of this week's This Week in Radical History, which was produced from the mobile fortress of Glee Studios. Thanks to the Radio Roots crew at WBAI and the Neighborhood Network of Columbus, Ohio for the audio I borrowed and abused. So did you like the shorter version or do you like the longer lengths? Let me know what you think by contacting me at themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. That's one long run-on word and address, themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. Got to run. This may be the end, but as always and forever, I am yours in the struggle, Mike Cannon.
We'd all be millionaires and movie gods and rock stars, but we won't. We
slowly learning that fact.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح. طفلة تمتطي.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is John Roberts. This week we are pleased to feature a presentation by Anna Bolzer, who is, among other things, an organizer for the U.S. campaign to end the occupation, and in that capacity has her finger on the pulse of organizing all over the country. Here she speaks at a peace action conference in Minneapolis, Minnesota, that took place in November of 2014. It is, among other things, a wonderful rundown of the status of the BDS campaign. But beyond that, she also offers some sage advice to all who are organizing around the BDS campaign and pro-Palestinian effort across the country. The presentation begins with her introduction. Here is Anna Bolzer of the U.S. campaign to end the occupation.
I'd like to call Anna Bolzer to the front. I've known of Anna for a number of years and always been impressed by her work and her presence. And I would like to tell you a few things about her. She's a Jewish-American public speaker, author, and activist for Palestinian human rights. At the present time, she is also the national organizer for the U.S. campaign to end the occupation. After graduating from Columbia University, she traveled to the Middle East in 2003 on a Fulbright grant to teach English in Ankara, Turkey. Since then, she has traveled to the West Bank as a volunteer for the International Women's Peace Service to document human rights abuses and support nonviolence resistance. Her publications have documented 8 months of human conditions while on assignment in the West Bank. Today, we are most grateful to have her present with us as she shares more of her experiences with Palestinians and maybe a little bit about the Fourth Precinct. We'll see. So welcome, Anna.
So thank you to Sabil and all the organizers for making this event happen. And thank you, everyone, for being here, especially at 1:30 on a Friday afternoon. I know it's not easy for everybody. So thanks for being here. It's an honor and privilege to talk to you. I'm excited to open up this conference with some commentary on the really amazing, extraordinary place that the state of the U.S. movement for Palestine is at today. I'm actually not going to be, the title of my talk is State of the U.S. Movement for Justice in Palestine, Building Power Through BDS and Joint Struggle. So that's actually going to be the focus of what I'm talking about. I've presented here in Minneapolis several times and the Twin Cities and nearby. I think I was here first in 2006 and then again in 2008, and I was just sort of reflecting on how much has changed really since last time I presented here in 2008, how the situation on the ground continues continues to deteriorate, and I think we'll be learning about that throughout the weekend. But also the movement for justice in Palestine has achieved milestones that I think were once unimaginable, and were even unimaginable in 2008 when I was last here. So it's really kind of extraordinary to reflect on how much has changed, and I want to comment a bit on that. And I hope this weekend can be a time for both deepening our understanding of the injustices in Palestine, but also committing together to working for justice effectively with clear principles. I called my talk State of the U.S. Movement for Justice in Palestine, knowing, of course, that I cannot possibly give you a comprehensive talk on everything about this movement because it is so big and widespread, and no one person even can keep track of it, let alone cover it in a one-hour talk. But I'll focus on two things that I think really show where this movement, how far this movement has come, and the power that has been built on a national and local scale to really start to challenge mainstream institutions and the dominant narrative in this country. It is difficult to overstate the significance of the Palestinian call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, a call made to us people around the world acting in solidarity, the way that this call has transformed the solidarity movement for justice in Palestine, putting agency back into the hands of people of conscience, with the Palestinian themselves as our center of accountability. So I want to start by talking about the way that BDS has worked, how it can continue working, and maybe give some concrete ideas, and then shift into talking a bit about joint struggle and intersectional work and how that has also enhanced this movement. So 10 years ago, Palestinian civil society issued a historic call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, similar to those used against apartheid South Africa, targeting Israel and institutional participation in its oppressive regime. And BDS comes in many shapes and sizes, and if we get the PowerPoint up, I can give you some examples of some of the really creative ways in which BDS is playing out around the country and just how widespread it is. But there are boycotts of Israeli goods and other products that are and services that are linked to Israeli apartheid. There's a boycott of Israeli academic and cultural institutions, which are part and parcel, of course, of Israel's military occupation. There is divestment by institutions like churches, like campuses, universities, municipalities, pension funds, banks, foundations, etc., in choosing to stop investing in companies involved in Israeli aggression. And there are other forms of BDS, including, of course, eventually getting to the S sanctions, whereby the U.S. government and governments around the world will impose sanctions on Israel to make it no longer able to continue its oppression of Palestinians. And the goals of the BDS movement are the fulfillment of the basic human rights of the different parts of the Palestinian community and society according to international law. These are uncontroversial rights and goals, namely, one, an end to the 1967 occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, two, equality for 48 Palestinians or Palestinian citizens inside Israel who live as second or third or fourth class citizens, denied the same rights granted to Jews in a Jewish state, and three, of course, the right of return for Palestinian refugees who are living in exile, who are the majority of the Palestinian population. BDS aims for these three basic rights, which are basic conditions of any just and lasting peace. But I want to talk most about BDS the way that I see it, which is as an incredible gift. Many of us were sympathetic with the Palestinian plight for many years. I can remember just how many film screenings we tried to do, speaking events, etc., and people wouldn't come, or it was always the same people who came, right? Vigils with always the same people, feeling like we're not getting anywhere, writing letters to Congress and getting back either no response or something comically terrible in response. There was a time that I remember even, and for people who've been doing this work for decades longer than myself, I'm sure you have even more examples, when I think a lot of solidarity activists, we were asking ourselves, what does it mean to work in solidarity with the Palestinian people, who are, of course, the leaders and primary agents of their own freedom struggle? And how can we actually affect change? And BDS has helped us answer this question, helping us see our specific role as solidarity activists, and it's also given us an extraordinary tool to build our power, and that's what we see playing out today in this country. And we have lots of evidence of it that I can talk about, and other speakers will be talking about as well. Beginning to influence real change. BDS has moved people from sympathy to concrete, effective action in the form of campaigns, guiding all of us to investigate the ways in which we ourselves are implicated in Israel's oppressive systems and to work to end that complicity. Because put simply, BDS is about ending our complicity and our collective compliance with Israeli apartheid. So every person in this room is implicated in multiple ways in Israeli aggression. And it is your job, it is our job, to investigate, to find out how, and to work to end that complicity. That's what BDS is really at its core. And it's not something heroic. Palestinians are not asking of us something heroic to end our harm. It's a basic moral obligation. And by demanding that we end our participation in Israel's war crimes, BDS is doing two things. First, it holds us accountable, as it should. But more importantly, it's giving us back our power. We are no longer waiting for President Obama or the U.S. Congress, or certainly not the Israeli government, to make change, because we are forcing that change ourselves with leadership from the Palestinian people themselves. And while the opposition will characterize BDS as nefarious and scary, we know, and violent even, terrorism even, they say they call it, we know that BDS is a nonviolent tool to address the extreme brutality and violence of Israel's occupation and apartheid policies. BDS utilizes well-tested, time-honored tactics in the legacy of the South African anti-apartheid movement and other anti-colonial, anti-racist freedom struggles. And it's working. For the first time in decades, the opposition is being forced to respond to us. We are on the offensive. Our movement is now defining the terms of the discussion. It's incredible. It's incredible. By bringing BDS to your community, you can take something that feels to many people as something very far away and international. We know it's not. But it feels that way to so many people, and localize it. Turning it into something that's a local issue, that the occupation is everybody's problem, and remaining neutral is not an option any longer. And as BDS resolutions come up for votes in municipalities, church assemblies, universities, and beyond, BDS is challenging people who could once ignore Israeli aggression, who could decide not to come to our film screenings or our vigils or our presentations, to finally take a side, to investigate what this is all about, and to figure out where they stand. Because we're bringing the occupation home, we're putting it on trial, and people have to confront the situation and learn about it. And in that way, BDS is actually, in my opinion, by far the best educational tool that we've ever seen. And now, according to a number of Israeli politicians, top business leaders, mainstream journalists, the wisdom seems to be that the only way to stop BDS and to avoid growing Israeli isolation is to restore Palestinian rights. In other words, BDS is working. We also know that BDS is threatening the status quo, given just how much the opposition is doing to fight it. And I believe that Cecily Zaraski from Jewish Voice for Peace, who's another plenary speaker, is going to be talking more about the ways that the Zionist establishment is fighting BDS and how we can counter that and resist it. So in the less than 10 years since the BDS call's inception, the BDS movement has established itself truly as a force to be reckoned with, and we have achieved milestones once unimaginable. The list is long and growing every day, so I would like to name a few of the ongoing campaigns and victories. It would be really cool to see some of the images. And as I was sort of talking about different types of BDS, so boycott, for example, consumer boycotts, targeting things like Israel. Israeli dates made on illegal Israeli settlements, Hewlett-Packard, which provides a lot of the technology used in racial profiling in the West Bank and the rest of Palestine. So consumer boycotts are one form of BDS. Divestment campaigns, like I was talking about, targeting corporations like these. Caterpillar, of course, providing the bulldozers used to demolish Palestinian homes, and olive groves to build the wall, etc. Technology used to surrounding Israeli settlements and more. These are readily available facts, so I don't expect you to remember all these details, but it's just to give you a sense of actually the breadth of potential targets, and then we'll talk a bit about how we strategically choose targets to have the most effective campaign possible. And I'll be talking a bit specifically about G4S as well, and there's a whole workshop on it, so I won't mention it there. I mentioned academic and cultural boycott, the ways in which Israeli academia and cultural institutions are part and parcel of Israeli aggression, and how, and I can talk a bit about how people can target those institutions. And then, of course, sanctions is very important. Here's kind of a graphic that can help sort of lay out BDS as a strategy for change. You know, ending the occupation, equality for Palestinian citizens of Israel, and the right of return. Those are those three goals that I talked about. The tagline being freedom, equality, and justice to match up with those. And then, of course, BDS. So, great. So we've achieved these incredible victories that honestly, I think the last time I was here in the Twin Cities, I don't think any of these had happened yet, and I think that we probably would have thought that they were coming in 20 years, not five. So we have campaigns all over the country, including here in Minneapolis, and it's one of the dots on that map. This is on our website, endtheoccupation.org. I have some brochures out there. But we are a coalition of more than 400 organizations around the country who are working to end all forms of U.S. institutional complicity with the Israeli occupation, including political and diplomatic support for Israeli aggression, and also things like academic, cultural institutions, corporations, etc. And we provide all kinds of support to groups like yours. So talking about some of the victories, students have really led the way in this movement, both, by the way, on BDS and on joint struggle, which I'll be talking more about later. But we see student divestment campaigns and other BDS campaigns unfolding on campuses around the country. These are predominantly often Palestinian-led student organizations. And here is a list that I compiled that is now, I have noticed, out of date, actually. I mean, there's so many, you can barely fit them on one slide anymore, of just how many different victories we're seeing around the country. It's extraordinary. One of my favorite examples that happened just this year are when students at Wesleyan University, who had been demanding divestment from the Israeli occupation, from fossil fuels, and from private prisons, as they were unable to get any response from the administration, and had tried all kinds of other tactics, escalated by actually occupying the offices of the university president to demand divestment, refusing to leave, even I think staying overnight or for many hours in any case, camping out. And lo and behold, eventually the president actually agreed to divestment from one of these three, from private prisons, which is an extraordinary victory and shows the way that I think students are really escalating the tactics in a very effective way at a great time to do it. And it's just very inspiring to learn from. And there's a really good video, actually, on it online, if you Google it. Churches, of course, especially presenting at our Friends of Seville conference, churches have been really leading the way as well, particularly on divestment, as well as boycott with the Presbyterian Church of the United States, the United Church of Christ. We have folks I work with on the ground, I think, in both of those here today. This is a screenshot that we saw on June 30th of this year of the UCC vote for divestment, as well as boycott, divestment from the Israeli occupation. It wasn't even close. It was amazing. I still get chills when I see this screenshot. you know, the Presbyterian Church, which is incredible, there was a 7-vote spread. So it was about, it was 50, you know, 0.001 versus 49.999. Wasn't even close this summer. So we see again that momentum building and the power that we're amassing, and also how awesome the UCC Church is. Quakers. Actually, Quakers preceded both of those. The Friends Fiduciary Corporation divesting from these different corporations involved in the occupation. I'll be talking a bit about Veolia as well, but that started several years ago already. And this is a similar sort of roundup of some of the biggest divestment victories that have happened, not just in the United States, but worldwide. And these are big deals. This is the Dutch ASN Bank. We're talking about national pension funds. We're talking about, major churches, pension retirement fund giants, the Bill Gates Foundation, et cetera, billionaire George Soros. This is no longer can we say that BDS is just about, being symbolic. And just about changing the discourse, we're actually seeing money moving in a way that is significant. One of the most exciting victories of this year, of course, was when R&B and I think 8-time Grammy Award winner is Lauryn Hill of the Fugees, previously heeded the call from Palestinians and their allies around the world, asking her to cancel a performance in Tel Aviv to hear that BDS call, and she did, in fact, and she joins a list of more and more cultural performers who are understanding that there can be no business as usual with an apartheid state, that it is wrong to go and perform in Israel when we know that Palestinian artists, for example, cannot travel outside, cannot be artists themselves, cannot even attend something like Lauryn Hill's concert. Another amazing victory of just the last year, of course, is Block the Boat. So Zim Shipping Company, Israeli shipping company, which docks in places around the country, including on the West Coast, was stopped by extraordinary coalitions all along the West Coast, blocking the boat, working with workers at the docks in places like Oakland, to work with them, to support them in supporting the Palestinian struggle, by refusing to unload goods from these Israeli ships, and they haven't been back. It's an amazing victory that really builds on the legacy of the anti-apartheid movement. SodaStream is, of course, a classic BDS victory. SodaStream being a homemade sort of seltzer water maker that for many years was produced primarily on stolen Palestinian land in an Israeli settlement. And there were SodaStream campaigns all over. In fact, was there one in here in Minneapolis? Yes, there was. Absolutely. In fact, Minneapolis, of course, is where Target is headquartered. And I remember activists here actually delivering a petition of almost 10,000 signatures to Target. Among probably many other things you did here, and I'll mention this later, but of course there's a wealth of experience here locally in the Twin Cities and in Minnesota on BDS campaigns that there's much to be learned from. But just this year, SodaStream finally has. Well, they haven't entirely shifted, but they are moving their factory headquarters out of the West Bank. Of course, they are now moving on to more stolen Palestinian land in the Negev, and so they remain complicit and remain a BDS target. But the fact that they moved their headquarters out of the West Bank really shows the power of BDS to change corporate policies. So we see that sort of that we're getting stronger and stronger. So I want to talk a bit about Veolia, especially in light of the focus, one of the focuses of this talk being on joint struggle. So Veolia is a multinational French corporation that focuses on trash waste collection, water, transportation, and energy. And it's everywhere if you start looking for their logo, which I don't have on a slide, but But I didn't even know they existed, and then now I see them everywhere. But Veolia was really a flagship BDS target, and it started in Europe, and then there were more and more campaigns happening actually in the United States and around the world to do things like stopping local contracts with Veolia, because Veolia was deeply complicit in Israel's occupation and apartheid policies through providing services to settlements, through their involvement in the Jerusalem light rail, entrenching the occupation in Jerusalem, etc. So I worked heavily on a Veolia campaign in St. Louis, where I live, as part of the St. Louis-Palestine Solidarity Committee, in addition to my role as national organizer. And we found out, and I give this as an example to learn a bit about what a joint struggle BDS campaign can look like, and then perhaps if it has local sort of implications for you guys, and something similar could happen here if it isn't already. We found out that Veolia was trying to gain a contract with our city's water department to what we believe is eventually take over our city's water. It was going to be an incremental, slow thing. But we found out about this at the last minute. Oftentimes it's very hard to find out actually who your city is contracting with, and you find out only when it's too late. But we found out just in time from a leak from a worker who was very disturbed by this, because Veolia, in addition to its complicity in the Israeli occupation, has a history of labor abuses, mismanagement, incredible environmental destruction. It's the world's largest water privatizer. So Veolia is a nasty corporation for many, many reasons. And so we, as the Palestine Solidarity Committee, we wanted to mobilize against Veolia. We had our eye on it. But we knew that we couldn't do it alone, that this was a big campaign. And we immediately, as we found out about the contract, began building a coalition with environmental groups, with whom we had real relationships. One of our members is also a member of the Sierra Club. We knew the people involved in the environmental movement in St. Louis, with workers and with others, to build a strong coalition to challenge this contract. We knew, as the Palestine Solidarity Committee, that environmental and labor groups were not going to rally around messaging for a free Palestine. And we didn't impose any sort of top-down messaging. We were building a coalition to challenge Veolia. That was it. And people were free, organizations were free to approach the campaign from whatever their motivation was, whatever their point of accountability and reference was. But we established some agreements early on about even if we were all going to approach this from different places, and here you can see one of our protests at City Hall, that we would not throw one another under the bus. So we were all going to fight the Veolia contract, and we were not going to allow ourselves to be divided. And indeed, the mayor, different people at City Hall, as well as national media, frequently were trying to divide our coalition, because it was so powerful to see the Palestine movement matching up with labor and with the environmental movement. They saw what incredible power that had. And in building our coalition, we understood that it was okay that different groups could bring different things. So the Palestine Solidarity Committee brought a lot of the organizing capacity. A lot of us had done these types of campaigns before. We were able to give powerful firsthand testimonies about what Veolia's policies meant in practice, having Palestinians testify at hearings to our city council about that. Environmentalists could turn up a lot of numbers, especially in the middle of work days. There were a lot of people from the Sierra Club who were retired or who otherwise were able to show up in ways that a lot of working class folks weren't able to do. So they were able to bring a lot of the people at particular strategic times. Organization for Black Struggle was part of our coalition. We had strong ties with them already through our relationships, which I'll be talking more about. And this could not be a priority campaign for them, and we didn't expect it to be. But they did, for example, an op-ed at a very key moment in our campaign in a major black newspaper in St. Louis, to add to our momentum and at a crucial time. Workers could not be public as part of the campaign. It would have been a threat to their jobs, but they gave us a lot of intelligence when we needed it. They checked in with us. They kept us accountable. So we sort of, building our coalition, what was really important about that, about having such an effective joint struggle campaign, was meeting different groups where they were at and acknowledging that we were all working from a place of good faith and commitment to justice. And in the end, it actually really worked to our benefit because it was actually extremely difficult for the St. Louis powers that be to develop an effective strategy to challenge us because we were everywhere. We appeared to be everyone and everywhere. There was no head. We were decentralized. It was as if the entire city of St. Louis hated Veolia and they couldn't keep track of us. So I think oftentimes when we're building coalitions, especially, we're looking for everybody to participate in an equal way. We're looking for we're looking for other groups to match, let's say, our organizational culture or our organizational style. We're looking for things to be extremely sort of developed in a very sometimes even corporate way of you know having our goals and how we're going to meet them by which time, etc. And what we found was that it was very useful for us to allow the coalition to be something that we couldn't control all the time. And we won. And so have a lot of other Veolia campaigns around the world. And just a few months ago, after losing more than $20 billion in contracts around the world following BDS campaigns, Veolia finally pulled out entirely from the Israeli market. An incredible BDS victory, just one of so many. So there are, you know, there's a lot of different campaigns to choose from. I want to look at a few different possibilities and then shift the presentation a little bit. But I do want to just really lift up Minnesota Break the Bonds and the work that it has done over the years building up BDS in this community and just highlight that they are going to be giving a workshop as well as Tori from Friends of Seville talking about G4S as a target, which I'll mention in this presentation as well. But to really, you know, learn from the experts here in your community. So there's a lot of, you know, different campaigns, and when you're looking at doing one of these BDS campaigns, deshelving Israeli goods at a local grocer, passing an occupation-free Minneapolis resolution in your municipality, perhaps, you know, is your university invested in U.S. companies building the wall and checkpoints, or are they partnering with Israeli academic institutions, or are they hiring G4S, a private security company that helps run Israeli prisons as well as U.S. detention centers? Are they hiring G4S for security? Is your church invested in and profiting from the occupation? A lot of the victories I outlined, you know, there's much more work to be done on those. Are there cultural performers traveling to Israel from the Twin Cities that you might influence to cancel? Or are there Israeli sort of cultural ambassadors coming to Minneapolis that you could protest or stop? Sports boycotts, I want to lift up that I think the very first time I saw sports boycott in this country was here in the Twin Cities when Minnesota Break the Bonds actually mounted a campaign challenging the fact that the Minnesota Timberwolves were going to play the Israeli Maccabi Haifa basketball team here locally. And they weren't able to stop the game from happening, but they ran a great campaign that I think really launched the idea of sports boycott in this country. So I want to lift it up. So I do want to mention two key targets from our standpoint at the U.S. campaign as sort of a bridge into joint struggle work, because these are also corporations that are heavily involved in other injustices. One of them is Hewlett-Packard, which provides technology to the Israeli Navy to enforce the blockade of Gaza, enabling the apartheid system and Israeli checkpoints. They're also heavily contracted with the U.S. Department of Defense and the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement in deportations and other racist practices in this country, side of their headquarters. G4S is another key target to look at and to start sort of monitoring its involvement here in your community. It's the largest private security company in the world. It operates Israeli prisons as well as U.S. privatized juvenile detention facilities and a lot more around the world. This is a nasty company, and these are also winnable, I believe, campaigns. These are campaigns that we might be able to see a sort of repeat of Veolia with regard to the occupation specifically. So, you know, there's a lot of great targets. UN is also contracting with G4S. You'll be hearing more about that later this month if you're on our email list. But the most important thing is not having a laundry list of, I don't know, products that you don't buy or companies you don't invest your own dollars in, but really strategically coming together to rally around a specific target, to choose the best target for your context. And I want to talk about some of the criteria that the Boycott National Committee, the Palestinian BDS National Committee, has recommended. And again, I encourage you to go to one of the workshops that's going to talk more in depth about building a BDS campaign. Of course, research, focusing together on one, as I said, looking at your particular context and where you can build power, where do you have influence. And the BNC talks about is the target something that's easy to explain and understand? Is it something that you can describe to people easily? Does it help build power and alliances? So when we're talking about companies like HP and G4S whose involvement in oppression is not limited only to Palestine, but involved in much more, and could be a strategic target for multiple groups. Is it a winnable campaign? Is it something where you can actually have an influence? So these are some things to keep in mind as you pick a target. And there's a lot of support, by the way, out there for you in launching and carrying through with these campaigns, including from our organization, the U.S. campaign. So BDS is one context in which some groups have effectively done joint struggle, like in the Veolia example, but it's really not the only way, or I would say even the main way of doing joint struggle, and I actually think it's a mistake when we approach joint struggle purely from the standpoint of corporations like G4S or HP without really having relationships and common understanding and mutual investment in other struggles. So I'd like to talk a bit about our experience doing Palestine to Ferguson work in St. Louis, where I live, especially given the amazing organizing happening here in Minneapolis following the horrible police killing of 24-year-old Jamar Clark, as Kathy was talking about, who witnesses say had his hands tied behind his back when police shot him execution style recently, and authorities are now refusing to release the tape of what happened. So I encourage people, in fact, I wanted to ask sort of how many people in this room have been up to the 4th Precinct to protest since Jamar was executed? Okay. How many people in this room have been to Black Lives Matter protests or affiliated actions? And how many folks have done work on police accountability, ending mass incarceration, dismantling white supremacy? Okay. I want to talk a bit about sort of what investment in these things has meant in our context in St. Louis and some of the beautiful connections that we've seen being built in an authentic way. So in addition to my national role, I'm also a local organizer with the St. Louis Palestine Solidarity Committee, which is an anti-racist, Palestinian-led Palestine solidarity organization. And in St. Louis, we've seen extraordinary cross-struggle solidarity that is manifesting between Palestine and Ferguson/Black Lives Matter struggles. This has really been happening more and more on a national scale, and we're seeing the connections being made everywhere, at demonstrations, in news articles, at conferences. There's a recent Black for Palestine statement that was incredibly powerful, and an amazing Black Palestinian solidarity video that just came out. I hope you've seen it. Palestinians are reaching out to places like Ferguson, and Black leaders are traveling to Palestine. It's extraordinary to see it happening in so many places, and it terrifies the Zionist establishment because it is really us building power together. And Zionist efforts that have gone back a long time to co-opt Black leaders are failing. Progressive, except on Palestine, so-called PEPs, are becoming increasingly obsolete. And polls show that as the U.S. becomes less white, it is also becoming less supportive of Israel. So I can say that in our context, locally, in the Ferguson movement in particular, the movement has been unambiguously pro-Palestine. It feels as if you cannot go to a Ferguson event without somebody mentioning Palestine and the crowd erupting in a cheer. And I want to talk about how those connections have been made, because I've learned so much from it. And I want to be clear that a lot of what has been done and has been effective has been specifically by Palestinians in the St. Louis PSC. It could not have done by white people. It could not have been done by white people in the PSC. And the role of white people has looked very different different, and we have had to learn and respect our different roles in this work. And I'll be talking a lot more about that in detail in my workshop, which is Showing Up as White Allies, Solidarity from Palestine to Ferguson, about what it is meant to prioritize Palestinian leadership, and specifically the role of white allies and understanding white organizing culture, those types of things. But from the very beginning, PSC members of all backgrounds have been on the ground taking part in actions, meetings. We were staffing safe spaces. Many of us already had long-standing relationships with radical black leaders, involvement in the Coalition Against Police Crimes and Repression, in the Organization for Black Struggle, with the issues of racism and police accountability. So we were already engaged and committed. And that's why I sort of put out that question about, you know, what people have done so far, because you really can't just start by trying to make those connections. It really starts with showing up and building those relationships and understanding. So, you know, just like at seemingly every Ferguson event, Palestine is mentioned, so too would we never have a Palestine Solidarity Committee event on Palestine that did not place our work in a broader anti-racist framework, challenging anti-black racism and white supremacy and other forms of oppression. Because we believe that challenging militarization and white supremacy and injustice in Israel is incomplete without also confronting and dismantling those systems here in the U.S. And I'll be honest, it's actually caused some friction in our organization. There have been people who really wanted us to keep really focused on Palestine. And to be honest, that the PSC has not been a comfortable space for all of those people. Some of them have decided to leave. And this has been a hard thing, I think, especially for white folks in the PSC. You know, St. Louis is a nice Midwestern city like the Twin Cities. You know, we want to be nice. We want to make sure everyone feels comfortable. But what we found was that as we were sort of adjusting our politics to be a more comfortable space for white liberal people, we were actually making that a less safe and comfortable space for other people. So what we found is by having really clear principles, we were actually creating a safe space for new people who have joined, and we've become a more multiracial and intersectional organization than we ever were before. And I can talk more about what that looked like in practice in my workshop. It also means strategic choices about our messaging. So are we playing to the liberal middle, or are we connecting with organizations of color? Sometimes you can do both at once, but not always. Sometimes you have to choose, and strategically we have chosen generally to be building power with other radical struggles. So anyway, we showed up, and we weren't there waving Palestinian flags or holding signs that said Palestinian Lives Matter. Absolutely not. We weren't carrying our organization's banner. We were there to stand in solidarity, lifting up the central message that became Black Lives Matter. When black leaders called for a weekend of resistance, we helped organize a Palestine contingent. So over and over again, we marched, we took part in civil disobedience, we got arrested together. We showed up there to take part in the struggle at hand. Here's part of our Palestine contingent. Just incredible, beautiful moments of cross-struggle solidarity over and over again. Palestinians from the PSC carried a banner at marches in Ferguson saying Palestine stands with Ferguson. They organized later with other people of color-led organizations to march together behind a banner reading United We Fight. So we showed up without centering Palestine, and that was incredibly important. People recognized the authenticity and drew the connections themselves because of their relationships with us. Connections that I think a lot of us are aware of. You know, that there are very real connections between Palestine and Ferguson and Black Lives Matter. You know, the fact that Israeli police are saying tear gas used against protesters in Ferguson and maybe here in Minneapolis too is used against Palestinians in Palestine, that the same corporations and sometimes people themselves are at the top of a lot of these policies. But knowing these connections and articulating them was not what made our work effective. It was not about having politics. It was about one thing, relationships. Who are you in relationship with? Who are you accountable to? And it was through these relationships, through showing up, through building those things that our work was reciprocal, but it wasn't transactional. It wasn't like we show up for you, so you show up for us. Not at all. They were relationships that made it so that we were understanding the ways in which we might be playing out white supremacy, or we might be making mistakes. In fact, we were making mistakes all the time. And I could give some examples, but actually don't. Was that a signal to me to to be quiet. I don't know what a time check is. I'll give an example that might be helpful. So about things not being sort of opportunistic, but actually being about building power for each other together. So, okay, Bill Gates Foundation divested last year from G4S. It was a huge victory. We'd run a campaign. In fact, it was a Palestinian-led campaign coming, an international one coming from the Palestinian BDS National Committee, calling on the Bill Gates Foundation to divest from G4S. In our messaging, in our petition, we gave the example of that G4S was running Israeli prisons as well as U.S. detention centers. We use that language to talk about G4S and what a nasty company it was and why Bill Gates should divest, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation should divest from it. And then when they did divest, we put out all of this messaging about victory, amazing, you know, mission accomplished, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation divested from G4S. Turns out a lot of our partners in the prison divestment movement felt a little bit thrown under the bus, because to them, G4S was really actually at the bottom of a long list of companies that are involved in U.S. private prisons. And so we'd sort of used their struggle as part of making ours win. But as soon as we won what we needed, we kind of declared, you know, mission accomplished. We'd learned by that time, I believe, with the Veolia victory. So, you know, in August when Veolia pulled out of the Israeli occupation and Israel altogether, you know, there was a temptation to declare victory and mission accomplished. But Veolia is still violating labor, you know, violating workers' rights all over the world, destroying our earth. It's still the world's largest water privatizer. And so we couldn't have a message of mission accomplished because we had real relationships with these groups that were working against Veolia. And so it allows us to check ourselves and to see where we are being opportunistic as opposed to building power for each other. And that's what it really has come down to. And it's messy, and it's long-term without immediate results, and it's hard, I think, especially for white folks who are used to often defining the pace and direction of everything that we do, including our own activism and including in our activist spaces, dominating those spaces in ways that we might not even realize. But, you know, I can say from personal experience, not ever having had to think about white culture or white organizing culture, or knowing that there was such a thing as white organizing culture, and having paid lip service for a long time about, you know, connecting struggles here with those in Palestine, without realizing the ways that I myself was manifesting white supremacy, even in organizing spaces. There's a lot to learn, I think, in investigating ourselves and doing that personal work, and of how we internalize those things and how they manifest in our work and the ways in which we end up reinforcing dynamics of power and privilege in ways that are damaging and can actually make joint struggle really challenging or even impossible. So this is sort of an invitation to white folks who really do want to do that difficult work of joint struggle. If you want to talk a bit, and I don't present myself as an expert, I don't think you can ever be an expert. It's a constant process of making mistakes and learning from them. But to continue this conversation in the workshop of what it means to show up as a white ally, and do that personal work and understand what white organizing culture looks like and ways that we might be marginalizing people of color in ways we don't even realize. So anyway, I invite folks who really want to do that work to come to the workshop and we can learn from each other. And with that, I think I will wrap it up. I hope I didn't take more than my time. And if there is time for questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
You have been listening to a presentation to the Peace Action Conference delivered in Minneapolis, Minnesota by Anna Bolzer of the U.S. Campaign to End the Occupation. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday when our feature presentation will be an analysis of the Israeli strategy of occupation by Palestinian attorney Diana Boutu. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.
Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, unwelcome guests.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go riding.
You're listening to episode 734 of Unwelcome Guests, The Case of the Missing Inquest. I'm Robin Upton, and that title points to, I think, the most suspicious circumstance around a highly suspicious event, the death of UK weapons inspector Dr. David Kelly, perhaps uniquely amongst recent unnatural deaths. There was no coroner's inquiry as to how and why his death came about. Instead, there was a rather toothless inquiry headed by a hand-picked appointee of Tony Blair himself. Now, we begin this show with a speech by Norman Baker MP, who took a year away from the Shadow Cabinet in order to research a book, The Strange Death of Dr. David Kelly, and I think this is from 2009.
As you've heard, I gave up a year of my front bench role to look at this matter, and I did so because it seems to me the events of 2003 are of critical importance to this country still in terms of how we are run, how those responsible for government behave, what the morality or otherwise of those in government is. And there is unfinished business from 2003. There's unfinished business in terms of the Iraq War. There's unfinished business in terms of David Kelly's death. We have an opportunity to pursue that now because the Chilcot inquiry is now underway. That's allegedly an independent inquiry to investigate the run-up to the Iraq War, the war itself, the conduct of the war, and the aftermath. I've met Sir John Chilcot, and I've raised with him issues of concern to me, including David Kelly's death. It's unfinished business because what happened in 2003 was a disgrace to this country, an affront to democracy, and cannot be allowed to happen again. Those responsible must be brought to book. Let me run through that in some detail. You may recall in the run-up to the war in 2003, we were told in increasingly strident terms by Tony Blair and Alistair Campbell and others, how the threat from Saddam Hussein was increasing, how it was necessary to try to head off these weapons of mass destruction which he had, how the UN had to be engaged in a desperate attempt to avoid war, and how at the last minute it was not possible to avoid war and very reluctantly we had to go and undertake that overseas expedition. Of course, the truth is entirely different to that. Tony Blair was asked on the 8th of July 2003 by the Liaison Committee, that's the senior committee of committee chairs in the House of Commons, when it was he decided to go to war. He said, "I decided that we could not avoid conflict in the few days before the vote on 18th of March, because it was then that it was obvious that we could not get a second UN resolution that delivered an ultimatum to Saddam. Up until that point, I was still working to avoid the conflict." So we're led to believe by Tony Blair that he decided only 3 months earlier, or 4 months earlier, in March 2003, that that was when war was inevitable. Interestingly, subsequently, there emerged in the Sunday Times a memo written by Matthew Rycroft, the Prime Minister's private secretary, taken in July 2002, which was headed, "This record is extremely sensitive, no further copies should be made, which is doubtless how it got to the Sunday Times. And it reports on the discussions between Sir Richard Dearlove, then the head of MI6, quaintly known as C, and this is what he is recorded as having told Tony Blair and the cabinet, or elements of the cabinet. C reported on his recent talks in Washington. There was a perceptible shift in attitude. Military action was now seen as inevitable. Bush wanted to remove Saddam through military action, justified by the conjunction of terrorism and WMD. But the intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy. July 2002. And what was the response of British ministers to that assessment from the head of MI6 at that point? Was it horror that the Americans are going to break international law? Was it a determination to use our so-called special relationship to rein them in? No, this is what Jack Straw, as Foreign Secretary, is recorded as saying in July 2002. It seemed clear that Bush had made up his mind to take military action, even if the timing was not yet decided. But the case was thin. Saddam was not threatening his neighbours, and his WMD capability was less than that of Libya, North Korea, or Iran. We should work up a plan for an ultimatum for Saddam to allow back in the UN weapons inspectors. This would also help with the legal justification for the use of force. So there's no doubt that ministers had decided in July 2002 to go to war. That's absolutely clear. At the very latest, they may have decided even earlier than that. And what happened after July 2002 and between then and March 2003 was a whole series of dossiers were produced, the famous dodgy dossiers, designed to convince parliamentarians and the public at large that the threat from Saddam was increasing and the military action was to be inevitable. That was a disgraceful deception when we were told, first of all, that no war had been decided upon and there had been, and then information was manufactured to justify the case for war. Hans Blix, the UN weapons inspector, subsequently said that the British government had taken the advice from the security services, the intelligence, and had changed question marks into exclamation marks. In other words, they corrupted the system for political ends. Tony Blair, that man again, said to the House of Commons this: there was no attempt at any time by any official or minister or member of No. 10 Downing Street staff to override the intelligence judgments of the Joint Intelligence Committee. That includes the judgment about the so-called 45 minutes. We were 45 minutes from doom, as you may remember, according to the headline in some of the papers. It was a judgment made by the Joint Intelligence Committee and them alone, which is contrary to what Hans Blix subsequently said about the interference. And I'm afraid the evidence is that Hans Blix was correct. Because we now know from the various drafts of the dossiers released that each one became stronger than the last, until the last one, which was finally released, was sufficiently strong to serve its political purpose. There were 16 textual alterations suggested by Alistair Campbell. This is the Prime Minister's press officer, remind you, not an intelligence officer, no access to intelligence data. He was suggesting textual alterations. For example, he suggested that instead of maybe a threat, it should be is a threat, which strikes me as not simply presentational changes, but changes to the whole thrust of the document. When it was quite plain in the initial drafts that London was not threatened directly, the 45 minutes related to battlefield conditions, the explanation that it related to battlefield conditions was removed, thereby allowing the Sun and the Evening Standard to run headlines 45 minutes from doom. Sir Roderick Braithwaite, you may not have heard of him, Sir Roderick Braithwaite, was a former chair of the Joint Intelligence Committee. And this is what he wrote in the Financial Times subsequent to the war. A spectre is stalking British television, a frayed and waxy zombie straight from Madame Tussauds. This one, unusually, seems to live and breathe. Perhaps it comes from the Central Intelligence Agency's box of technical tricks, programmed to spout the language of the White House in an artificial English accent. There is another possible explanation. Perhaps what we see on television is the real Tony Blair, the man who believes that he and his friend have the key to the horrifying problems of the Middle East. Mr. Blair's prime responsibility is to defend the interests of his own country. This he has signally failed to do. Stiffened opinions, but often in the wrong, he has manipulated public opinion, sent our soldiers into distant lands for ill-conceived purposes, misused the intelligence agencies to serve his ends, and reduced the Foreign Office to a demoralized cipher because it keeps reminding him of inconvenient facts. He keeps the dog, but barely notices if it barks or not. He prefers to construct his foreign policy out of self-righteous soundbites and expensive foreign travel. And may I remind you, that was the former chair of the Joint Intelligence Committee, the senior body of officials looking at intelligence for the government. Tony Blair has never been held to account for that. He has, in a matter beyond satire, where does Private Eye go now, been appointed, of course, as a Middle East peace envoy. So we then had a Hutton inquiry. The Hutton inquiry was set up following the death of David Kelly, officially to look into the circumstances surrounding the death of David Kelly, to which obviously I'll return in a lot of detail in a moment. But what Lord Hutton did with his inquiry was to spend the time discussing whether or not the BBC was at fault for the situation which has arisen, including David Kelly's death, or whether it was in some way the government. And surprise, surprise, Lord Hutton concluded that the BBC was guilty of everything and the government was guilty of nothing. It was the most disgraceful so-called inquiry, I think, in this country's history. So disgraceful was it that when we had the results published in January 2004, it forced the resignation of Greg Dyke, the Director General of the BBC, Gavin Davis, the Chairman of the BBC, Andrew Gilligan, the reporter who'd been involved in the story, and led to that spontaneous demonstration of BBC staff as they walked out of Television Centre and stood there defending Greg Dyke in a manner which reminded me of nothing so much as the Prague Spring of 1968 in Czechoslovakia. It was the nadir for the BBC. And then we had the vomit-inducing sight of Richard Ryder, the BBC's number two to the Director General, coming out to make the most obsequious apology to the government for what the BBC had allegedly done. What the BBC had done was report the facts. That's what they'd done. There was a marginal error in Andrew Gilligan's report, but essentially the report which caused so much fuss when he reported that the dossiers had been sexed up, that report was essentially correct. But all those people at the BBC resigned. Nobody from the government resigned over the Iraq war. Nobody. Not the Prime Minister, not the Foreign Secretary, not the Defence Secretary. Nobody. That's the kind of country we have to live in at the moment, and this is why this is unfinished business. We cannot ever allow again a government to behave in that way and to get away with it. And the Chilcot inquiry gives an opportunity at least to bring in political terms that was responsible for that desperate period to book. But then when that report was published in January 2004, and it was clearly so far wrong that it generated ridicule and disbelief in equal measure from the public at large, I wondered if he was so wrong on the issue of the BBC versus the government, whether he was actually right on David Kelly. Because David Kelly, whose death had prompted this whole business, had rather been forgotten in the inquiry. The inquiry centred, let us say, largely on the government and the BBC. And poor old Dr. Kelly didn't feature very much at all. There then appeared a number of letters from eminent and highly qualified medical experts in The Guardian and other newspapers disputing the suggestion that David Kelly could have died in the way that Lord Hutton described and suggesting, in fact, it was clinically impossible for him to have done so. Those letters worried me, and I began to look into the matter. And the more I looked into the matter, the more concerned I became. I subsequently wrote an article for the Mail on Sunday in July, I think, that year, 2004, and it generated the biggest response of anything I've ever done in politics. About 1,000 people contacted me by email, letter, telephone. All bar two were supportive of the concern I expressed and urged me to go on with my investigations. The public clearly weren't convinced by Lord Hutton as far as David Kelly was concerned. And as you've heard, I took some time out from my party's front bench when the opportunity arose to look into the matter, and the result is this book, The Strange Death of David Kelly. Let me now turn to the events surrounding David Kelly directly from July 2003. David Kelly had been cleared over a long period of time by the Foreign Office, though less so by the Ministry of Defence. He occupied a curious position of really acting for the Foreign Office, but being technically line-managed by the Ministry of Defence. He'd been cleared by the Foreign Office to engage in discussions with journalists and to give off-the-record briefings, and this had gone back many years. And therefore, for him to meet Andrew Gilligan, as he did at the Charing Cross Hotel, was not out of the ordinary. And he gave him background information, not for direct attribution. What changed, of course, was that the allegation that the government had deliberately sexed up the dossier was highly charged and went to the heart of the case for the Iraq War and the government's behaviour. It was a charge which is essentially proven to be correct subsequently. Anyway, when that was first broadcast, Alistair Campbell and those around him went ballistic and declared war on the BBC and sent large numbers of letters to the BBC on a kind of hourly basis demanding apologies and retractions and everything else. Part of the strategy was to then, I think, involve David Kelly on the government side, whether he wanted to be involved or not. He had gone to the Ministry of Defence to say, I think I might be responsible for this story, inadvertently or otherwise. There was then a decision taken, and the evidence for that is in the book, that there was a meeting involving Blair and Jeff Hoon, at which it was deliberately decided to leak Dr. Kelly's name or force it out in order that he could be used as a pawn in the battle between the government and the BBC. Not a very edifying way to deal with a public servant who'd done immense good for his country and for the world, but that was what was decided by those politicians. Subsequently, then, he was outed, thanks to Jeff Hoon and others, and that led to his appearance at the Foreign Affairs Committee on the 16th of July 2003, when he faced a difficult time. He wasn't used to the public gaze in that sense, and he was treading a fine line between not making matters worse, I think, in terms of what he said to Andrew Gilligan, while not lying, obviously, to MPs in that session. Now let me give you the official version of events, as Lord Hutton will describe it. The events of that particular committee meeting were harrowing for David Kelly, so Lord Hutton will tell us. He wasn't used to that. He came away thinking his career was at an end. He was very depressed. He then spent a couple of days mulling over it, and on the Thursday, he left his house for the last time, carrying with him his boyhood knife and 30 coproximal tablets, with the intention of slitting his wrist, taking the tablets, either to aid death or to deal with the pain of the wrist slitting, and there he passed quietly away on Harrowdown Hill. That explanation is wrong in virtually all regards. Let me deal with his mood, first of all. And his mood is, if you like, circumstantial. It's not possible to always be inside someone's mind. But insofar as we can tell what was in his mind, he was certainly not suicidal. First of all, those I've spoken to who know him very well, including UN weapons inspectors, colleagues, close friends, those who live in his village, all will absolutely state that he was the last person in the world to commit suicide. He had dealt with very harsh and difficult episodes, including revealing, forcing out details of an illegal bioweapons program by the Soviet Union / Russia, and indeed the Iraqis in the early 1990s. He was not the person to be intimidated by a bunch of MPs. However, that you might say that we don't know whether that's really what he was like. That's not proof, and I accept that. He went to the Intelligence and Security Committee the next day, on the Wednesday. This is generally not known. But I've got the transcript from that meeting. He gave evidence there. He was in much better form, even cracking jokes. And on the Thursday, the last day of his life, he was sending emails to friends saying the worst was over. I was looking forward to getting back to Iraq, and he actually spoke to the Ministry of Defense and booked a flight to Iraq the following Thursday. Emails were sent at 11:18, shortly before he left the house for the last time. In addition to that, his wife was ill in bed that lunchtime, and his daughter was about to be married. So it had to be a particularly selfish act, I think, for him to have gone to commit suicide at that point. And all the evidence, circumstantial evidence on his mood, suggests that that was a highly unlikely action for him to have taken. However, that is not definitively proven one way or the other. What is much more difficult to rebut is the clear evidence which can be accumulated concerning the alleged method of death. The knife which he was supposed to have used, we never saw it. It was never produced at the Hutton Inquiry, but were led to believe it was a knife he'd owned since boyhood. It was a sort of gardening knife with a lip on it. It was also a blunt knife. It was the most curious weapon to use if you were out to try and kill yourself. We're told that he cut the ulnar artery. The ulnar artery, for those who aren't medically qualified, and I wasn't and still not, but I learned about the ulnar artery, is in your hand here. It is only accessed by cutting nerves and tendons. It would have been particularly painful to have cut through nerves and tendons to get to this artery, particularly using the knife which I've just described. It's also an artery of matchstick thickness, and therefore, you might think, unlikely to cause death by loss of blood. Particularly as you use a blunt knife, the wound will heal up more quickly than if you use an absolutely sharp knife. I asked the national statistician, Karen Dunnell, how many people had died from cutting the ulnar artery in 2003 in the whole of the UK. The answer, you may be surprised to know, is one, presumably Dr. Kelly. If you want to, and I'm not suggesting you do want to do this, but if you were to want to cause death by loss of blood, then the suggestion is you might cut your arm this way, and put it in hot water. I'm told that's the way you might achieve death. Don't try this at home, as you say on Blue Peter. Many people will assume that what you should do is, in fact, to cut the radial artery across here. And certainly that's what they'll do on television programs. And that, of course, will cause the loss of blood to a far greater degree than it would cutting the ulnar artery. Interestingly, a study of U.S. prisons and attempts by U.S. prisoners to kill themselves by cutting the radial artery in the 1990s showed that, I haven't got the figure in my head, I think if one out of 279 prisoners only was successful in killing themselves by cutting the radial artery, which would have caused a loss of a great deal more blood than cutting the ulnar artery. So even that is uncertain, at the very least, to cause death. It's also the case if you cause a wound of any significance, blood will spurt out because the heart obviously is still beating and pushing the blood round. So you might think, might you not, that in those circumstances there'd be rather a lot of blood around Dr. Kelly's body if he's supposed to have bled to death. Not an unreasonable assumption. Yet when the paramedics arrived on the scene in Harrowdown Hill, they weren't actually clear how you were supposed to have died. Why was that? Because there was no blood. There was no blood evident. The only blood on his clothing was a small spot of blood about the size of a 50p piece on one knee, and his left arm had been was blood-soaked, consistent, I might also say, with a cut after death rather than one before it. If he was going to have cut his ulnar artery with his right hand, which obviously he would have had to have done, you might have expected blood to have spurted up and to cover his right hand and his right sleeve. Not a single drop of blood, not one, was found on his right hand or his right sleeve. How can this be? Extraordinary feat from David Kelly to be able to cut in that way and leave not a single drop of blood. And there are some other curiosities as well about this knife and the alleged method of death. I asked the Thames Valley Police in a Freedom of Information request subsequent to the Hutton inquiry whose fingerprints were on the knife. Do you know what they said? They said to me, I've got it in writing, there were no fingerprints recovered from the knife. Very curious for David Kelly to have been able to cut his ulnar artery without leaving fingerprints. He wasn't wearing gloves either, by the way, just in case you're wondering about that. Mai Pedersen, who was perhaps David Kelly's closest friend, they were Baha'i faith members together. They worked together in Iraq. She was, is in the US Army. I've spoken to her at some length. She says that David Kelly had earlier on that year injured his right elbow quite badly, and when they had a meal together in a restaurant, so bad was the injury, he was unable to cut steak with his right hand. And yet here we are expected to believe that he chose his right hand to cut with a knife into the ulnar artery. David Kelly knew more about the human body than most people. If he had wanted to commit suicide, he could certainly have chosen a more effective and certain way than a method which had killed nobody so far that year in the UK. It is inconceivable a man of his knowledge and intelligence would opt for such a clumsy method to try to kill yourself. Now, we're also told by the Hutton inquiry that a contributory factor to his death was the ingestion of coproximal tablets. And certainly in his jacket at the scene where he was found, there were three blister packs neatly put in inside his jacket of 10 coproximal tablets each, and altogether 29 tablets were missing. One tablet, for whatever reason, had been left inside in situ. We are then perhaps invited to conclude that David Kelly must have swallowed 29 coproximal tablets. And yet, the official toxicologist at the Hutton inquiry, Alex Allen, said there was less than half a tablet in his stomach when he was examined. And even if you allow for the possibility that the tablets had metabolized into the bloodstream, he concluded that there was less than half the lethal dose at maximum available to kill him. Coproximal tablets are also implicated in liver failure. Had you taken an overdose of coproximal tablets and failed to kill yourself, you would cause yourself significant long-term liver damage. Again, I don't think it's very likely that someone like David Kelly would have taken that risk. Had he wanted to kill himself, which I don't think he did, but had he wanted to kill himself, I'm sure he wouldn't have chanced long-term liver damage with an uncertain means of suicide. There's another curiosity as well about these coproximal tablets, or quite a few curiosities really, but one of the curiosities is that Mai Pedersen again made it known that David Kelly had an aversion to swallowing tablets. He would avoid doing so. He would take liquid solutions rather than swallowing tablets. So we're invited to believe that David Kelly is suicidal, he's masochistic, and he's illogical. I don't think he was any of those things, as a matter of fact. Now, in order to swallow the tablets, you might think that he would require a good deal of water, because if you try swallowing 29 tablets of coproximal tablets with a long axis, that will require a good degree of water. You might also conclude, as medical opinion suggests, that if you have lost a lot of blood, as we're invited to believe he has done, he's supposed to have bled to death, then the body, in those circumstances, will want to consume water as a compensation. So did he consume a lot of water? There was a water bottle there. It was rather curiously placed, 10 inches from his left shoulder, which is difficult to see how he would put it there. But the water bottle itself was one of those small ones you buy at railway stations for about £1. It was about half full. So we're invited to believe that in order to swallow 29 tablets and compensate for the loss of blood, he actually only swallowed half a bottle of water. The bottle was smeared with blood. So I asked Thames Valley Police whose fingerprints were on the water bottle. No fingerprints were recovered from the water bottle, they told me, which makes you wonder how the blood got on there. Then there's a position of the body. But the volunteers who first found the body, the search volunteers, are adamant that the body was propped against a tree, upright, with the legs spread out and the back against the tree, or at least the head against the tree. And indeed, I suppose we're going to sit in the wood, and if you are going to kill yourself, then that's a logical position to be in. What then happened was that a police officer came along called D.C. Coe. He was left with the body for 25 minutes. And when the paramedics arrived, after D.C. Coe had been there, the paramedics told Lord Hutton the body was on its back, a little distance from the tree. So did D.C. Coe move the body? Well, D.C. Coe was asked about this, and he said he observed the scene from 7 or 8 feet, but got no closer. He was there for 20 to 25 minutes. Now, I don't know about you, but even if you're a professional police officer, I think you would take some notes of what happened and what the scene was. 20 minutes is a long time to do nothing in a wood with no distractions, with the body in front of you. Now, I suggest that you might examine the body. Even if you didn't touch and disturb the scene, you would get rather closer than 7 or 8 feet. It seems a rather curious proposition that D.C. Coe puts forward. So presumably he did monitor the scene, didn't he? Well, no, because he couldn't tell Lord Hutton if if David Kelly had a cap on his head or it was away from the body. He wasn't sure if he was wearing walking boots. He didn't know whether the watch was on the knife or whether it wasn't. Was there water in the bottle? I wasn't sure about that either. He doesn't seem to have recorded very much in his 20 to 25 minutes. But we do know that the scene described by the volunteers who found David Kelly is different to the scene described by the paramedics who came subsequently, not simply the position of the body, but, for example, the volunteers had said that the right arm, David Kelly's right arm, was beside the body. The paramedics said it was on top of his chest, and lots of other changes like that as well. There's also the interesting issue as to what David Kelly was actually wearing, because Acting Superintendent David Purnell from Thames Valley Police told the Sunday Times on the 20th of July that David Kelly had left his house, quote, dressed in jeans and a cotton shirt despite the poor weather. That is sort of backed up by his Guardian the day before, the day after Kelly was found, Saturday's Guardian, and the Observer and the Mail on Sunday, which had him, quote, dressed casually in an open-neck shirt and jeans with no coat. Curious, then, that a green barber wax-type jacket was found at the scene, his wax jacket, including where the coproximal tablet pack, blister packs were found. Some inconsistencies. You might think that Lord Hutton would want to get to the bottom of this, wouldn't you? You might think that if he's having an inquiry into someone's death, he might want to try to reconcile the various different facts. That, I'm afraid, is not what Lord Hutton sought to do. Lord Hutton, in fact, took a rather interesting approach to the inquiry, as subsequently appeared from a piece he wrote about it in 2005. He wrote this in the Inner Temple Yearbook. Now, it's a racy publication. I'm sure you've come across it, but just in case you haven't, let me read to you what Lord Hutton wrote about his own inquiry 2 years earlier. At the outset of my inquiry, it appeared to me that a substantial number of the basic facts of the train of events that led to the tragic death of Dr. Kelly were already apparent from reports in the press and other parts of the media. Therefore, I thought that there would be little serious dispute as to the background facts. I thought unnecessary time could be taken up by cross-examination on matters which are not directly relevant. That's how Lord Hutton approached his inquiry, in his own words. And therefore, when the police gave conflicting evidence, as they did, about where the body was, what he was wearing, where the water bottle was, how many police officers even were there, because they're all matters which the police themselves contradicted themselves on. What did Lord Hutton do about that? Lord Hutton concluded, he noticed the inconsistencies, and when he reported, he said that the fact that there were inconsistencies shows the police were honest in telling the truth. Because, this is the reason why, because if the police had all said the same thing, he would suggest they had concocted the story. The fact that they all told different events shows that they were honest, but perhaps had poor recollection. That was Lord Hutton's conclusion on that. And then there were interesting moments when it looked like the inquiry might actually get somewhere. Nicholas Hunt, for example, the pathologist, when he was questioned. The first opening salvo to Nicholas Hunt was this from James Dingerman, QC, he's a QC for the Hunt Inquiry. Quote, "I am not going to trouble you with the details of the toxicology report," was the first thing he said to him. Why not? That's what he's there for. Why not ask him about the toxicology report? He wasn't subject to any cross-examination, despite the curious aspects of the case. He was asked, however, at the end of his evidence, which didn't last very long, if you could tell from the examination if there were any signs of a third-party involvement in Dr. Kelly's death. This is what he said, the pathologist. "The features are quite typical, I would say, of self-inflicted injury, if one ignores all the other features of the case." So what happened then? Was Dr. Hunt asked what those features were? No. "Thank you very much." That's what happened then. He was asked then, was there anything further he would like to say on the circumstances leading to Dr. Kelly's death? This is what he said. "Nothing I could say as a pathologist, no." Rather curious answer, isn't it? You think somebody might want to pursue that point, but nobody did. So how was it that we had such a ludicrous inquiry, a joke of an inquiry, which failed to do what any normal process would do? Answer, it was not a proper inquiry. It was a statutory inquiry. It was a non-statutory inquiry. Now, that may sound like a rather technical point, but it's actually terribly important. Lord Hutton was appointed with all due speed. For those of us who don't believe the government sometimes acts fast enough and takes a long time to do anything, take heart from the speed with which Lord Hutton was appointed. According to official event, Tony Blair was in the air on the way from America to Japan, more than halfway there, when he was told of the Dr. Kelly's body being found. This is the official version. He then spoke to Lord Falconer, the relevant minister, and to Alistair Campbell. It was decided that there ought to be an inquiry into Dr. Kelly's death. It was concluded that Lord Hutton would be the appropriate person to chair that. It was necessary to sound out the Master of the Rolls to see whether he was in agreement with that. It was then necessary for Lord Falconer to go to visit Lord Hutton to discuss the matter with him, at which the terms of reference would be agreed. Lord Hutton then had to agree the terms of reference and mull over the matter. He then had to agree. Lord Falconer had to appoint him, and it had to be reported back to the Master of the Rolls and to Tony Blair. And you know what? All this happened before Tony Blair actually landed in Japan. Astonishing speed with which the government can act when it wants to do so. But of course, what that did mean was that when the stories in the papers were written that day, they were written about the establishment of an inquiry, not about the circumstances surrounding David Kelly's death. A very convenient change of direction. Now, in this country, if you believe in the rule of law, we have something called a coroner's inquest. And when somebody suffers an unexplained or violent death, there is an inquest. That inquest is established under proper procedures, long-established proper procedures, at which, for example, people give evidence under oath, they can be subpoenaed to attend, and the normal safeguards of a court procedure will apply. The rules of cross-examination, for example, and the hurdles required to reach verdicts. For example, in a coroner's inquest, you have to be convinced beyond reasonable doubt, that's the hurdle, before you can bring in a suicide verdict. Beyond reasonable doubt. I just wind you back for the last 10 minutes and ask you whether you think this is beyond reasonable doubt in this case. But of course, we didn't have a coroner's inquest, because the Oxfordshire coroner, Nicholas Gardner, began to look at the matter, as indeed he would. It was within his bailiwick, within his jurisdiction. But then what happened? Lord Faulkner, a government minister, who'd been in touch with Tony Blair, of course, about Lord Hutton's appointment, told the Oxfordshire coroner he was being replaced in this matter by Lord Hutton. But the Oxfordshire coroner said, well, I'd like to carry on a bit further. But then Lord Faulkner wrote to him and said, I'm bundling you off the case. You must stop your work now. And I've got those details. I've got those letters because Harriet Harman very helpfully released them to me under the Freedom of Information Act. So we know what Lord Faulkner wrote to the Oxfordshire coroner. It's all there in black and white. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm not particularly comfortable with a government minister telling a coroner to get off the case when it's a significant death like this. But that's what happened on this particular occasion. And Lord Hutton was appointed. And Lord Hutton was appointed under the Coroner's Act 1988 under a provision which has been not very often used. Now, that provision was brought in by the then Conservative government for actually quite a sensible reason. Because when you have a situation such as, say, a train crash, and you have multiple deaths, all of which have the same cause, then it's actually more efficient and less heart-rending for the individuals involved, the family members and so on, if the matter can be dealt with as one inquiry rather than having a series of repetitive inquests. So that provision was brought in to deal with that situation. On every occasion, there haven't been very many, it's been four or five, on every occasion since then when that provision has been used, there have been multiple deaths, except for David Kelly. And on every occasion when that's been used, the coroner's inquest has been replaced by another statutory process, such as the 1921 Tribunals Act, with the same legal safeguards, except in the case of David Kelly. And what we have with David Kelly was a non-statutory inquiry with as much legal formality as my talk to you here today. No more, no less than that. So Lord Hutton didn't have the ability to summon witnesses. He wasn't required to summon witnesses. There were key witnesses who didn't attend. My Pedersen, who told us about David Kelly's aversion to swallowing tablets, who had information about his state of mind being his closest friend, who knew that he damaged his elbow and couldn't cut with a knife shortly before he died. Thames Valley Police told Lord Hutton she'd nothing of interest to tell him. So she wasn't called to give evidence. The police officer in charge of the inquiry, Alan Young, wasn't asked to give evidence. He didn't appear at the Hutton inquiry. He wasn't even mentioned. I found out afterwards he was a man in charge. We didn't even know he was there. Didn't know he existed until then. And other key people weren't invited to attend either. So we had a partial inquiry in terms of those who turned up. We had an inquiry where there was no proper cross-examination, as demonstrated by some of the many loose ends which had been left hanging. And we had a so-called inquiry where people were not under oath, they could not be subpoenaed, they could, if they wished to, lie with impunity. That is not a satisfactory way to deal with perhaps the most controversial and sensational death of this century, but that is what happened. And in addition to that, as I've mentioned earlier, Lord Hutton, in fact, spent relatively little time on David Kelly and a great deal more time on the BBC. That is a disgrace of a process and needs to be remedied. Now, there's one more thing about the coroner, because the coroner was effectively told that he did one last duty, which was to issue a death certificate. So he issued a death certificate which gave the reasons for death as incision of the ulnar artery and ingestion of coproximal tablets and potentially a complementary cause related to hardening the arteries or some heart condition, which, by the way, had not been picked up when David Kelly had had a medical shortly beforehand and it was unknown to his GP. That certificate was issued, I think, on the 14th of August 2003. Lord Hutton's inquiry had been in place for less than a week, and none of the evidence relating to David Kelly had been heard. So one might conclude, what was the point of Lord Hutton's inquiry if the death certificate had already established the cause of death? One might also conclude, what was the point of asking the coroner to issue the death certificate if Lord Hutton was about to look into the matter? Either way, that cannot be squared as a process. And I would suggest to you that the conclusion that Lord Hutton reached in his ludicrous and informal inquiry is, in legal terms, unsafe and cannot be sustained. So I'm in no doubt at the end of that, looking into all that, and I've only, frankly, touched the surface and with the matters. There's a lot more detail in here, which is even more, I hope, compelling. I concluded at the end of that that there was no other conclusion that could be reached than that had been murdered. It clearly wasn't suicide for the reasons I've given. It clearly wasn't a natural cause, and it clearly wasn't an accident. So that's the only explanation which you're left with. Now, that's a very uncomfortable conclusion to reach. It's also a rather dangerous conclusion to reach for someone who's a member of parliament, because it's outside the normal comfort zone which we operate in. Although many of my colleagues will tell me sotto voce they agree with me, they don't want to come out and say so very much publicly. It's a dangerous place to be in terms of political credibility. But I have to go with where the facts are. You can't disavow the facts. They are as they are. I then went on to look into who might have caused David Kelly's death and for what reason. And that was much more difficult, obviously. If you find somebody metaphorically with a knife in their back, it's not difficult to conclude they've been murdered. It's much more difficult to establish who's done it. My investigations took me into contact with members connected with the security services, both in this country and America, with UN weapons inspectors, with people in his own community, in his own village, with others who had something to say. And my Mail on Sunday article, which I referred to, had in fact generated about 30 responses, specifically providing new leads or new information about David Kelly's circumstances, which was useful to be able to take forward. There isn't an obvious person or body responsible. Now, I've in my book gone through and identified what I think happened. And I think the key to understanding what happened is to ask why it is that he was found as he was in Harrowdown Hill. If you accept, as I hope you do, that he did not inflict those wounds upon himself and that they were not the cause of death, then the key question is why those wounds were inflicted, why it was that the ulnar artery was cut, why it was that the impression was given that he had committed suicide, why was it a strange death. And the only logical answer to that is that it was an attempt to make a murder look like suicide. That's the logical explanation for that. And as someone in the KGB once said, any idiot can commit a murder. It takes an artist to commit a suicide. And I think there's some evidence of that there. Why would you do that? Well, the book goes into some detail as to who might have been responsible and dismisses those theories. For example, I don't think it was in the interest of the government of the day to have Dr. Kelly killed. I don't rule out that possibility, that governments do behave in that way on occasions. I spoke in part of my inquiry to Wouter Basson. Wouter Basson is, as you may or may not know, the man who was engaged by the apartheid regime in South Africa to develop weapons, first of all, to be able to kill people without it being detected, and particularly to be able to kill black people and not kill white people. That was his task. He had a lot of money and resources to enable him to do that. If you want to read about it, it's all there in the Truth and Reconciliation hearing, which have been published in open session by the South Africans as a result of what Nelson Mandela put in place around the turn of the century. I spoke to Wouter Basson. His view was that, first of all, he knew David Kelly and said he wouldn't commit suicide, but he also said to me, if you think Western governments don't have the capacity to commit assassinations, then you're naive. I'll leave that with you. You can make up your own mind about that. But there was no obvious political motive for Tony Blair and his colleagues, whatever else they did, to have been responsible for David Kelly's death. It caused a storm for them, which may have led to the downfall of the government. So it's difficult to see what motive they would have had in that matter. Others may have had other motives. And I go through that in the book, and I explain to you in there why I've reached a conclusion, which I have. I'm conscious of the time, and also that I want to bring some people in for questions, so let me stop there. But let me just say what I want out of this process and why I'm doing it. I want three things. First of all, I want a coroner's inquest. I've indicated in my book what I think happened. I've indicated why the conclusions Lord Hutton has reached are wrong, but I don't pretend that I'm a replacement for a proper legal process. I'm not. But I think there should be a proper legal process. I think if we don't stick to that basis in law, then it's a very dangerous road we go down. So there should be a proper coroner's inquest. Secondly, we need a proper and full inquiry into the Iraq war. I hope that John Chilcott will provide that. And I'm certainly more hopeful, having spoken to him, that he might be get somewhere nearer it than Lord Hutton did. But we need to bring to book those who lied to us, including our Prime Minister. He can sue me if he wants. Who lied to us in 2003 about what was the position regarding Iraq. Those people need to be brought to book. And thirdly, I think given what David Kelly did to make the world a safer place and the service he gave to this country and to the world, it would not be inappropriate if there were some posthumous recognition of his work on this planet. It is perhaps ironic that when he was found, which, by the way, I forgot to mention, was just after Parliament had gone to recess for a number of months, so we couldn't ask any questions about it, when he was found dead in the woods in a rather sad way, Tony Blair was receiving 17 standing ovations from the US Congress for giving some sort of moral justification to George Bush's illegal war in Iraq. One can't help thinking that there's something rather unjust about that comparison. I would like to see David Kelly recognized for the work he did, because while Blair and Bush were causing wars, David Kelly had actually done quite a lot to avoid them. He was the one who had taken away the weapons of mass destruction, not Blair and Bush, and I think that should be recognized.
Now, we continue with an interview with Dr. David Halpin, who, as a retired surgeon, observed what was claimed about Dr. David Kelly's death and said that that made no sense at all based on his experience as a doctor. And with a group of other doctors and a coroner, formed a legal opposition to the David Kelly case and tried to challenge that in the High Court. And this is an interview after the UK government's decision to refuse to reopen the inquest into Dr. David Kelly's death. It's from December 2011.
I was told to expect failure, all right? So I'm not weeping. I might weep later. But nothing has changed. You don't bleed to death from cutting the ulnar artery in your wrist. That, as a surgeon, many surgeons will tell you, doesn't happen. That's what was said to have happened to Dr. Kelly. The other thing which hasn't changed is there's still no inquest. Do you understand me? There was no inquest worth its salt 8 years ago, well, 8.5 years ago, and there's been no inquest today. All they've done is to refuse an inquest, all right? So the facts haven't changed. What we've been trying to do is to uphold the laws of our country, and I'm afraid the laws of our country have been trampled in this case, because Dr. Kelly is unique for several decades at least in not having had a proper inquest for his unnatural death. Do you understand me? He didn't die of pneumonia. He died, we found him in a wood with a cut in his wrist and some empty packets of pills alongside. The thing is, the law that we saw today, or we were subjected to, was quite arcane. It was quite complicated, really. And but you have to keep saying, what's it about? And what it's about is that there was a man died unnaturally, as I've said, and a Lord Chancellor, who also had another post, he was Secretary of State for Constitutional Affairs, he decided, whilst within a few hours of Dr. Kelly's body being found, he decided to have an informal inquiry, an inquiry without an oath. That's an ad hoc inquiry. Added another thing later, called 17A. We can discuss that as well. Not enough time. But the thing is that he did it. The alacrity that Lord Falconer applied to this case was extraordinary. Consider the Chilcott inquiry. I call it the conversation because it has no law. Nothing will happen. that started 6.5 years after they first started killing people in Iraq. 6.5 years. Kelly's inquiry, or at least the appointment of it, happened the morning his body was found. Worked that one out. Well, we know why it was done like that, because Falconer wanted to contain the inquiry so that everything was filtered, do you see? So the police didn't come forward with evidence saying there were no fingerprints on the knife, no fingerprints on the spectacles, no DNA or something. A lot of evidence was retained. And you say, why was it retained? If it was an inquest with suicide, these things would have come forward. We've had to prize these facts out one by one, particularly a man called Miles Goslett, a journalist, freelance journalist, and he has, through freedom of information requests, got these things out. It was hard, it was mentioned today, but not in the right context, you see. What we heard today was a small part of what you would get at an inquest. If there was inquest, it would run for about 6-7 weeks on this man, and then the country would know his death was properly investigated. At the moment, it hasn't been investigated at all, whatever you're told.
The government will certainly be hoping this is the end of the matter.
No, it's not. No. I can tell you there are millions of people in this country who were shocked by his death and remain certain that they haven't heard the whole story. I'm not saying that he was murdered. Maybe he was a suicide. But what we do know is the inquiry was insufficient.
I get the impression you believe it was a lot deeper than just...
I do. The story about him being the source, he wasn't the source anyway of this sexing up. We all knew the dossier was sexed up to justify the Iraq war. Millions of people knew that in this country. So that was a known, do you see? So it wasn't as if that was any great secret. But if you look at the... it is complicated, really, but he had access to a lot of information. He had five hard drives in his house with encrypted, apparently. They were removed by the police after he was found dead. And I feel he would have known what was being used in Iraq. And if you look at my website, the website of David Halpin, and you look at an essay I wrote, which was Tony Blair... My favorite person. That wasn't the title. Tony Blair, Questions Before Charge. If you look down the bottom of the essay, you will see some pictures. There's a picture of a lady in Palestine who's got shrapnel in her tummy, died. And there's a picture of a boy called Ali Abbas, whose arms were burned off, incinerated. So he's armless. He's back in Baghdad now. And that boy, Ali Abbas, his arms were incinerated by I don't know what it was exactly, but it was some type of nuclear weapon. Right. 10 days from when the bombardment started, Ali Abbas, his mum and dad, and 10 relatives were incinerated in the same house that night. There's no weapon I know about which can cause that, which is conventional. And I think Dr. Kelly might have known about this. You see what I mean?
Kinds of weapons.
Well, I think that don't ever believe that we don't use some pretty vile weapons. You know, what is a weapon of mass destruction? 1,000-kilogram bombs. Where they're now talking about using nuclear-tipped bunker busters in Iran. You see? So I think Kelly might have known that. I don't know, but he was a very intelligent man, a conscientious man, I think, and I would suspect that he knew something. That this is, of course, assuming that there was foul play. We don't know that. What we need is a proper inquest. I was born in 1940. I was the eldest of four children. My sister, who's the second one down the line, was here today supporting me and supporting this country. I'm a patriot, so is she, so millions of others. And we want a country to be truthful and not to be corrupt. This country is corrupt at the top and for a long way down, you know? To lie, when I was a little one, to lie was a cardinal sin. So when I see untruthfulness, when I see a lie, I have to react. And I cannot stand lies, hate lies. And this is why I've stuck with it. And I know this is a lie, this case, you see. Not necessarily. He may have taken his life. I think it's unlikely. The thing is, it hasn't been inquired into properly. So it's a lie. You must, if people are quiet in the face of untruthfulness, then they are lying with it. Silence is complicity. So that's what it really is, my upbringing, which I think was quite common in the war years and just afterwards, Second World War. We were taught to be truthful. And this isn't truthful. We are, as I say, in this country, mired, that's in the bog, mired in mendacity, in lies. There's lots of lies. PR is lies. In that House of Commons down the way, there's lots of lies. On that piece of paper, I'll say this, actually, I'll just repeat it to you. It's, in fact, a nice little statement I wrote yesterday afternoon, and it says, "Hold this in your hearts. John Locke, who was the leader of the Enlightenment in Britain, said this in 1675, and I wish John Locke was here today. He said, where the law ends, tyranny begins. And that sounds rather heavy, but in the spring, in the House of Commons, they bundled in an act called the Geneva Conventions Act, 1957. They bundled it in with another act, the Police and Order Act or something, and this is at the request of Israel. I see you nod. Miss Livni and other people had lobbied the parliamentarians of both sides, Labour and Conservative. They'd lobbied them to remove this act or to emasculate it. And it's emasculated. So the last person that they tried to question here under this act was Doron Almog. I was involved with it, actually, with a very good solicitor called Makova. And they managed, they've emasculated it now. They have to go to the Director of Public Prosecutions to seek a warrant. But by the time they've done all that, they're on the phone and they've flown off wherever they're going to. Do you understand me? So you see what I mean, you see? That's exactly true. Where the law ends, tyranny begins. They removed the law, and in that, we now know that war criminals can be walking along here without any chance at all, really, that they will be apprehended and brought to book. So our world becomes more lawless, not just our country. So that's what I'm standing up for, is the law. We tried it today, a bit arcane, very tricky, pretty expensive. We haven't won, but nothing has changed with Dr. Kelly. His death remains improperly investigated. And as I said before, you don't bleed to death from a cut ulnar artery. That's manifest rubbish, as another surgeon told me.
And that interview was by Hassan Khani of Press TV UK. That's an Iranian-backed TV channel which was banned in the UK. We continue with another Press TV contribution. This is a documentary entitled The Death of Dr. Kelly, An Open Case, and it's from January 2013.
On the 20th of March 2003, US and British forces invaded Iraq under the pretense of destroying weapons of mass destruction. In 2009, the Iraq Inquiry was created to examine Britain's role in Iraq. Seen by many commentators as a marshalled and well-orchestrated production, the inquiry, led by Chairman Sir John Chilcot, was met with mixed responses by the public.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you very much for coming. My name is Sir John Chilcot, and I'm the chairman of the Iraq Inquiry.
In the months leading up to the attack, British Prime Minister Tony Blair perpetuated a lie about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq in a bid to manufacture consent for the war. The Blair government claimed that Iraq had weapons capable of striking Britain within 45 minutes. It emerged later that this claim about Iraq's capabilities had been denied by a prominent British weapons scientist, Dr. David Kelly, during meetings with reporters. A few weeks later, Dr. Kelly's body was found near his home in suspicious circumstances. In 1996, a plan for the invasion and occupation of Iraq was finalised in the White House by neocons Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Perle, John Bolton, Dick Cheney, and Donald Rumsfeld. Richard Perle stated that the plan was to wage total war by using the US military to invade and occupy any country that opposed America's self-serving foreign policies. Pearl even believed people would sing great songs about them for years. According to Bob Woodward's book, Plan of Attack, when the White House decided to accelerate their plans to invade Iraq, Blair was not consulted. Condoleezza Rice informed the British government, and it was not until the next day that Bush spoke to Blair personally and thanked him. Third source, also in a position to know. In the months leading up to the attack, U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell presented misleading drawings to the United Nations about WMD in Iraq.
I believe that Iraq is now in further material breach of its obligations. I believe this conclusion is irrefutable and undeniable. Iraq has now placed itself in danger of the serious consequences called for in UN Resolution 1441.
Standing shoulder to shoulder with the Americans, British Prime Minister Tony Blair parroted the lie about WMD in a bid to manufacture consent for the war.
It is the case that if the only means of achieving the disarmament of Iraq of weapons of mass destruction is the removal of the regime, then the removal of the regime, of course, has to be our objective.
Iraq probably has no weapons of mass destruction in the commonly understood sense of the term, namely a credible device capable of being delivered against a strategic city target. It probably does still have biological toxins and battlefield chemical munitions, but it's had them since the 1980s, when US companies sold Saddam anthrax agents and the then British government approved chemical and munitions factories. Why is it now so urgent that we should take military action to disarm a military capacity that has been there for 20 years and which we helped to create? Why is it necessary to resort to war this week while Saddam's ambition to complete his weapons program is blocked by the presence of UN inspectors? Only a couple of weeks ago, Hans Blix told the Security Council that the key remaining disarmament tasks could be completed within months.
What was really important about this business of sites given was that when we reported that no, we didn't find any weapons of mass destruction, they should have realized, I think, both in London and in Washington, that their sources were poor. Both Condoleezza Rice and Prime Minister Blair, I sort of alerted to the fact that we were skeptical, and I made the remark then that I cited many times that, look, wouldn't it be paradoxical for you to invade Iraq with 250,000 men and find very little?
Well, I think what is interesting when you look back in my lifetime is when Harold Wilson was the Prime Minister of Britain in the 60s, is that the Labour government of the day did not go into Vietnam. Under enormous pressure from Lyndon Johnson, they said no. Tony Blair, for some reasons that most of us don't understand, was persuaded to go into Iraq, or I didn't even think he was persuaded. He was side by side with the most right-wing, somewhat eccentric president in history in the United States. So it's still a question. I mean, the question that still isn't answered is, why did he do it? Now, Tony Blair says, because I believed it was right. Well, I'm afraid that's not enough. That's not good enough.
Why do you think the Prime Minister was ignoring the warnings you were giving and going ahead?
I think this gets to the root of why we went. And I think now you can see the leaked documents. The Americans were determined to go. Blair had said he'd go with them. He couldn't get Britain there without going through the UN. But in the end, if the Americans were going, he was determined to go with them. And I repeat, I've said it before, but it's very important. There was no need to go at that time. There was no emergency. There was nothing happening that meant we couldn't have more time.
It's often said that Mr. Blair made Britain the tail of the American dog. But I don't really myself buy that. I actually believe that the British were co-conspirators. They were co-murderers of hundreds of thousands, maybe more than a million people in Iraq, which is a crime of almost unimaginable proportions and knocks the crimes of Mr. Charles Taylor or Mr. Ratko Mladic into a cocked hat, actually. I believe that Mr. Blair was intellectually superior to Mr. Bush, that he led Mr. Bush rather than was led, The British were not deceived by the Americans. The British and the Americans, in concert, hatched a conspiracy to deceive the world.
The idea that we doctored such intelligence is completely and totally false. Every single piece of intelligence that we presented was cleared very properly by the Joint Intelligence Committee.
Now, 8 years on, of course, we now know that, of course, they sexed up the case for war, which is what the allegation was. Of course they did. And I don't think I meet anybody who doesn't think they sexed up the case for war.
But the point, just to keep focused on at the moment, is that the actual quality of the intelligence...
I did believe it. I mean, that was the... And I did believe it, frankly, beyond doubt. And
beyond your doubt, but beyond anybody's doubt?
Our partners in Washington are less interested in disarmament than they are in regime change in Iraq. And that explains why any evidence that inspections may be showing progress is greeted in Washington not with satisfaction, but with consternation, because it reduces the case for war.
Did you feel that it gave Iraq a realistic possibility of meeting the requirements of the resolution?
Yes, except that... It was very hard for them to declare any weapons when they didn't have any.
Hans Blix had voiced concerns about the US regime's desire for war against Iraq. He was on record as saying that Bush and Blair were exaggerating the issue in order to invade, a position he maintained in the lead-up to the war. Blix has also said that the Blair government would have liked to have gone down the diplomatic route to disarm Saddam Hussein, but became a prisoner of a US policy heading towards war. Blix faced a barrage of intense criticism from Washington and the neocons for speaking out. It was later revealed that Tony Blair had already secretly committed Britain to war in 2002, promising George W. Bush that UK forces would join the US-led invasion, come what may.
It concludes that Iraq has chemical and biological weapons, that Saddam has continued to produce them, that he has existing and active military plans for the use of chemical and biological weapons, which could be activated within 45 minutes.
This false claim about Iraq's alleged WMD was one of many contained in what came to be known as the Dodgy Dossier, a fraudulent document endorsed by Downing Street Press Secretary Alistair Campbell.
Did he tell President Bush in writing during 2002 that he would support the President if he took military action?
Alistair Campbell, Downing Street Press Secretary, 1997 to 2003.
I think that I would certainly say the tenor of the Prime Minister wrote quite a lot of notes to the President, and I would say that the tenor of them was that, as I said earlier, we share the analysis, we share the concern, we are absolutely with you in making sure that Saddam Hussein is faced up to his obligations and that Iraq is disarmed. If that can't be done diplomatically, and it has to be done militarily, Britain will be there. That would definitely be the tenor of his communications.
Claire Short, former UK Secretary of State for International Development.
This is about the special relationship. Was Blair willing to say to the Americans, I'm not going with you now, it's too early, Blix should have more time, the international system needs more time to prepare. I promised you I'd be with you, but this is the wrong time, we can take another 6 months. And I think he was so frantic to be with America that all that was thrown away. And if he'd done that, his place in history, the UK's role in the world, would have been so much more honourable. But, and this is, Britain needs to think about this, the special relationship. What do we mean by it? Do we mean that we have an independent relationship and we say what we think, or do we mean we just abjectly go wherever America goes because we think that puts us in the big league? And I think that was it, and it's a tragedy. That is the tragedy.
On the 29th of May 2003, a story broke, questioning the Blair government's arguments for war. This would go on to send shockwaves through the British establishment. Andrew Gilligan, a BBC reporter back in Britain from Iraq, reported live at 6:07 a.m. on BBC Radio 4's Today programme that a news source had told him that a dossier about the military capabilities of Iraq was made sexier in the week before its publication in order to support the argument for going to war with the country.
The central claim in his dossier, which he published in September, the main case, if you like, against Iraq, and the main statement of the British government's belief of what it thought Iraq was up to. And what we've been told by one of the senior officials in charge of drawing up that dossier was that actually the government probably knew that that 45-minute figure was wrong even before it decided to put it in. What this person says is that a week before the publication date of the dossier, it was actually rather a bland production. It didn't the draft prepared for Mr. Blair by the intelligence agencies actually didn't say very much more than was public knowledge already. And Downing Street, our source says, ordered a week before publication, ordered it to be sexed up, to be made more exciting.
The source of this story was the UN and British Ministry of Defence weapons inspector, Dr. David Kelly. Eventually, it was confirmed that Dr. David Kelly had been the source for BBC journalist Andrew Gilligan's story.
He was he'd come forward to the Ministry of Defence, as he thought, in confidence. He'd been promised that his name wouldn't be revealed as the source. They'd then broken that promise. They'd outed him. They'd quite deliberately leaked, or effectively leaked, his name to the press. They gave the press a series of clues, which enabled anyone with an internet connection to guess his name. They then confirmed the name to any journalist who guessed it, and one newspaper, for instance, put more than 20 names to the Ministry of Defence press office before it confirmed David Kelly's. After the name emerged, they then pushed the Foreign Affairs Committee of the House of Commons to interview him, even though it had already finished its inquiry and didn't actually want to interview him.
Greg Dyke, BBC Director General, 2000 to 2004.
What happened after the war, of course, was we ran a piece on the Today programme early one morning saying that a source from within the intelligence community had had alleged that the government had fixed the case for war, that that they hadn't properly scrutinised the intelligence and put it through the normal process. As a result, we ran the story. As a result, the government went ballistic. They then leaked out the name of the person they thought was our source, a Dr. David Kelly.
He was paraded on television in front of those MPs, subject to a very unpleasant experience for him. He was harangued by one of the MPs. It was called Chaff. And he was asked a number of questions about his interactions with journalists, to which he did not give totally frank answers, and I think that worried him. And the Ministry of Defence told him that they were going to investigate some of those answers.
Treating you uniquely as a civil servant, in highly publicising you before going to the Intelligence and Security Committee.
That's the conclusion you can draw.
The feeling I have, and you might be able to help me on this,
certainly this 45-minute claim, which came up in a British government document 6 months before the Iraq war and was repeated, I think, three times in the document, that Iraq could have its weapons of mass destruction ready within 45 minutes, which was given massive publicity in this country, he knew that wasn't true. Probably he knew a lot of other things were not true as well, but he certainly knew that wasn't true. So one day he carries on with this process of talking quietly to journalists, which he'd been encouraged to do for about 10 years, and suddenly what he says is not acceptable for once.
At that time it mattered acutely what he was saying, because he was the only person of authority, a professional person, who was evidently leaking the story that there were no, in his view, almost certainly no weapons of mass destruction. And this was before we'd invaded a neutral country, contrary to international law. So therefore, they had every reason to be worried about what he was saying. It could have removed the pretext for war. It seemed to be doing so.
On July the 17th, 2003, Dr. David Kelly was found dead in suspicious circumstances on Harrowden Hill, near his home in Oxfordshire. With Dr. Kelly's sudden demise, the government no longer had to fear what he may or may not have known, or what he may or may not have revealed to the public about the war against Iraq.
I came across him as somebody with an expertise in a field I was covering, Iraqi biological and chemical weapons. I can't exactly remember at this distance when my first meeting was or how it came about, but we had a number of one-to-one meetings. He was a good source. He'd given information which had been reliable in the past. We met up in May 2003 to talk about Iraqi things. I'd not long come back from Iraq. He was interested in that. Obviously, the war had only just finished, and we got to talking about the dossier, and he said it had been transformed to make it sexier. He said that one of the key pieces of intelligence that had underpinned the dossier was single source and wasn't regarded by him and other experts as reliable.
Individuals who are of a particular moral fibre or who are highly principled may take a view which differs from the view being expressed by government. And they may be conducible, but perhaps not if they're of such high integrity. And it may be that such people come under various pressures in order to be able to change their view. We see it as an everyday event, so far as members of parliament are concerned, that may want to vote against a government whip. There are all kinds of pressures that each of us are placed under. And undoubtedly, David Kelly had many pressures, professional, public, personal, which he had to face.
In journalist Christopher King's Redress Information and Analysis report, published on May the 20th, 2010, he concluded that the Blair cabal found that it had put in the public spotlight a weapons inspector of unimpeachable competence and integrity, who had sufficient knowledge and authority to destroy their entire case for war at a time when public feeling against the war was high.
Jim Brann, a spokesman for the Stop the War Coalition.
You cannot look at the Kelly case without looking at the 12 years that went before it. And really, the 12 years that went before it is itself an enormous crime. And out of it comes the Kelly case. And I think it's very striking, for example, in this country where we have a free press, as they put it, that they promoted the Iraq war on the basis of Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. And then there was some kind of scandal when there were no weapons of mass destruction. But they managed to keep completely quiet the deaths of many, many people under the 12 years before that. They've just buried that question. And really, the Kelly case is part of that big scandal.
Retired surgeon Dr. David Halpin.
His death, whether by his own hand, by suicide, or whether it was in fact homicide, murder, was all to do with the Iraq war. Kelly wouldn't have been dead if there wasn't an Iraq war. And the Iraq war was founded on a pack of lies. Blair and Bush and the rest of the cabal had snatched WMD and all the rest of it from thin air as a pretext for annihilating Iraq. I'm exaggerating a little. That's what, in effect, has happened. Iraq has been finished by this, like Galloway said, like wolves, you know, being set upon the country. Dr. Halpin quotes me as talking about Britain and America falling on Iraq like wolves, but I later apologized to the wolves because no wolf would ever have committed such a savage and unnecessary act of mass destruction.
The legal ramifications for Tony Blair and his government were quite clear, conspiring with the US to deceive the British public and launch a war of aggression against Iraq would be a direct violation of the Nuremberg Accords, and leave the Blair government open to prosecution as war criminals. The Hutton Inquiry, whose head, Lord Hutton, was appointed by the Blair regime, convened on August 12, 2003, to investigate the death of Dr. Kelly. The inquiry exonerated Tony Blair and ruled that Dr. Kelly's death was a suicide.
I'm satisfied that Dr. Kelly took his own life in the wood at Harrowdown Hill at a time between 4:15 p.m. on the 17th July and 1:15 a.m. on the 18th July 2003, and that the principal cause of death was bleeding from incised wounds to the left wrist, which Dr. Kelly inflicted on himself with the knife found beside his body.
The Hutton Inquiry's findings were widely regarded by experts as a whitewash and a government cover-up. After all, Lord Hutton was appointed by the very government he was supposed to investigate, thus posing a conflict of interest.
There was an investigation done by someone called Lord Hutton, who was appointed by the government, and as one member of the government told me at the time, or told us at the time, you know, we appointed the right judge, and they did. They appointed a judge who found for them.
The inquiry that took place with Lord Hutton wasn't an inquiry that investigated all the possible angles. It took place at a time when it's quite possible that there were people who ought to have come to give evidence were not called, and those people who did come and give evidence never gave evidence on oath. And I think it's a big failing that there hasn't been an inquiry like an inquest where a coroner could call particular people to attend and insist that they're there, and when they come, ask them to give evidence on oath.
So I felt uncomfortable about the level of the investigation into the circumstances of death, and I felt extremely uncomfortable as a doctor, and indeed I have never spoken to another doctor who has done anything other than agree with me that it's highly improbable that anyone would ever die from hemorrhage as a consequence of the severance of the smaller of the two arteries in the left wrist.
As the curtain came down on the Hutton inquiry, an epic sequel was already in the works, as crowds and players alike rolled up for the Iraq inquiry. British Ministry of Defence weapons inspector Dr. David Kelly was found dead in suspicious circumstances in 2003, after he was revealed as the source in an investigation that dismantled the government's lies about Iraqi WMD and the case for war. The controversial Hutton inquiry, set up to investigate Dr. Kelly's demise, was seen by many as an extension of the government's cover-up, and as more evidence came to light, it soon became clear that the death of Dr. David Kelly was still an open case. Another important aspect of the story is how the media covered these events. The BBC especially was criticised by many experts for their coverage of the Hutton inquiry, the death of Dr. Kelly, the issue of WMD in Iraq, and the subsequent war.
My research found that the BBC from the beginning has been particularly cautious in the way that it's covered this issue. One could perhaps argue, understandably, given the kind of pressure that the BBC was under at the time and ever since. But I would argue that that kind of caution is exactly what we don't want from our public service broadcaster, exactly what the public does not expect from the BBC.
The intelligence community remains convinced weapons of mass destruction will be found in Iraq. Only then will all the doubts go away. Gavin Hewitt, BBC News.
The BBC is as much of a state information bureau as many of the state information bureau that they routinely condemn. This is, if you like, in the DNA of the BBC, that it requires to please its political masters. And in the aftermath of the Iraq war, we saw this in all its ugliness, the way in which the then Blair government was able to completely defenestrate the leadership of the BBC, getting rid of the chairman of the Board of Governors, as they then were, getting rid of the Director General, as he then was, Greg Dyke.
I don't think the media itself caused the war. I mean, the war was caused by George Bush, who wanted to go to war, and Tony Blair, who decided to support him. But without media on side, I think, or without some of the media on side, I think Tony Blair would have had great difficulty getting the decision to go to war through the Houses of Parliament.
In reaction to the widespread criticism and pressure from the public on one hand and the government on the other, the BBC issued a statement on the 28th of January 2004. The statement reads, "The BBC does accept that certain key allegations reported by Andrew Gilligan on the Today programme on May the 29th last year were wrong, and we apologise for them. We would point out again that at no stage in the last 8 months have we accused the Prime Minister of lying, and have said this publicly on several occasions. Although some groups are vocal in rejecting the ruling that this was a suicide, not everyone finds fault with Hutton's verdict."
And essentially, the 45-minute point was probably the most important thing that was added, and the reason it hadn't been in the original draft was that it only came from one source, and most of the other claims came from two. And the intelligence agencies say they don't believe it was necessarily true, because they thought the person making the claim had actually made a mistake.
A lot of the things which seemed superficially suspicious about his death actually had perfectly plausible explanations. The relative lack of blood has been described by a group of doctors the other week as suspicious. They say he couldn't have died from cutting as he did the ulnar artery, which is a small artery that closes up when it's cut. Now, that may or may not be true. And in fact, the pathologist who did the original post-mortem has been in the papers this week saying there was actually quite a lot of blood and he could easily have bled to death from the ulnar artery alone. However, the cut to the ulnar artery was only one cause of death. The full cause of death is a combination of that with two other things: the fact that his long-standing heart condition and the fact that he swallowed 29 coproximal tablets, a powerful pain-killing tablet. And a lot of pathologists have said that the combination of those three things, the interaction of them, is a totally and perfectly plausible cause of death.
Because of the interest in the political issues that formed the backdrop to Dr. Kelly's death, a significant number of people have raised concerns about his death and the process used to investigate it, and have called for a new inquest to be set up. At this stage, only the High Court can order an inquest, and then only on an application made by me or by another with my consent. I was asked last year to make such an application, and have since then been provided with a large amount of information which is said to support the case for an inquest. Mr. Speaker, having given all the material that's been sent to me the most careful consideration, I have concluded that the evidence that Dr. Kelly took his own life is overwhelmingly strong. Further, there is nothing I've seen that supports any allegation that Dr. Kelly was murdered or that his death was the subject of any kind of conspiracy or cover-up.
I have never been a conspiracy theorist, and I think it's quite difficult to see who would have wanted Dr. Kelly dead. Certainly the security services wouldn't have wanted him dead. But I think if you go back to the whole of the Hutton inquiry and what it looked at, I mean, the inquiry itself was quite interesting. The only trouble is Lord Hutton drew conclusions that no sane person could have drawn.
The central reason why I do not believe he was murdered is that I cannot see in whose interest it would have been to murder him. I mean, if you think about it, it could not possibly have been in the British government's interest to murder him, because his death plunged them into a huge crisis, a crisis from which they never really recovered. And anyone with an iota of sense in Whitehall would have known that killing him would create such a crisis.
Challenging the verdict, anaesthesiology specialist Dr. Searle Sennett, diagnostic radiology specialist Dr. Stephen Frost, Dr. Christopher Burns Cox, Dr. Andrew Rouse, and retired surgeon Dr. David Halpin submitted evidence to the Attorney General in 2011. They were applying for a new inquiry into Kelly's death. We interviewed Dr. Halpin in December 2011 after the court refused their request.
You don't bleed to death from cutting the ulnar artery in your wrist. That, as a surgeon, many surgeons will tell you, doesn't happen. And that's what was said to have happened to Dr. Kelly. The other thing which hasn't changed is there's still no inquest. Do you understand me?
Yes.
There was no inquest worth its salt 8 years ago, or 8.5 years ago, and there's been no inquest today.
Edward Mint and Mary Cheatham are local citizens of Farringdon in Oxfordshire, where David Kelly died. They, like many others, are dismayed by the refusal to hold an inquest.
I just can't believe that when David Halpin made this application to the Attorney General for a judicial review, that how Grieve could say there was no justification for reopening the inquiry or having an inquest. I would have thought there is loads of things to be answered. And then we have the coroner at the time, Nicholas Gardner, saying he was sort of lent on. There was no suggestion that he should not hold an inquest. Far too many things are completely wrong with the whole business.
At first, we didn't take an awful lot of notice because it seemed to go... Everybody said that Dr. Kelly had committed suicide. Right from the start, it was assumed that. Of course, very nicely for the powers that be. But then we began to query the whole thing. And I actually bought 4 copies of Norman Baker's book, and I've passed them around my friends and anybody who was interested. And I think they too have become convinced that Dr. Kelly was murdered.
In May 2006, former Lib Dem MP Norman Baker resigned from the Shadow Cabinet to pursue an investigation into the alleged murder of Dr. David Kelly. In his book, The Strange Death of David Kelly, he writes, "I believe there are enough doubts, enough questions, enough of a smell of stinking fish to justify reopening this episode officially. As far as the government's actions are concerned, we need a full and independent inquiry into the events that led us into war, and those that followed in the years after, when British troops were in Iraq. As far as Dr. Kelly is concerned, we owe it to a good man to set aside the face of a process that occurred and create a new process that inspires public confidence and examines this matter officially, openly and honestly, and with the rigour that the people of this country are entitled to expect." Experts maintain that the Hutton Inquiry's findings retain little to no credibility in light of evidence surrounding Dr. Kelly's death. Lord Hutton refused to call the head of the Thames Valley Police Investigation, Alan Young, to give evidence. The South Central Ambulance NHS Trust claims to have lost the patient report form completed by paramedic Vanessa Hunt at the scene of Dr. Kelly's death. And Dr. Kelly's death certificate does not state a place of death.
We thought there would have been more blood over the body if someone bled to death.
What sort of experience have you got in going to attempted suicides and where people have indeed slashed their wrist?
Well, everyone that works for the ambulance service has been to that type of injury. And yes, there's usually more blood around.
Do people normally die from that sort of injury?
I've never been to one that's died yet.
You've been to a number of them?
Yeah.
A good example is the evidence that the police had gathered. You know, the journalist Miles Goslett and others, Baker, Norman Baker the MP, another journalist, Garrick Older, through Freedom of Information requests, have got out very important evidence which should have been put before the Hutton Inquiry. It was withheld from the Hutton Inquiry. One of the key things is that there were no fingerprints on the handle of the knife.
The Thames Valley Police had conducted a series of tests on items found with Dr. Kelly's body, and they'd searched for fingerprints and DNA evidence, and they'd found that, in fact, there were no fingerprints on any of the items found with his body. Personal items like his glasses, his wallet, keys, his watch. None of these things had any fingerprints on them. What's curious, of course, is not just that there were no fingerprints on any of these items, but that this fact was never raised at the Hutton inquiry. Nobody ever asked the police who gave evidence to the inquiry about that. So, of course, you have to wonder whether an active decision was taken not to raise this.
Now, I can imagine, as a doctor, what Kelly would have been, his physical state would have been like, what his mental state was like, perhaps, as he was sat there wishing, you know, gathering courage to kill himself. He would have been sweating. That's part of the fingerprint. The reason why fingerprints happen is sweat on the papillary ridges. To find no fingerprints on a knife is extraordinary. So the police who were involved with this case would have wished, I would have thought, to bring forward to Hutton that there were no fingerprints on the knife. And yet, throughout the Hutton inquiry, people, and Hutton himself says, you found evidence of third-party involvement, he said several times. Well, the thing is that if one was in the court, he said, I'm sorry, excuse me, sir, there were no fingerprints on the knife. How do you account for that? He wasn't wearing gloves, you see? So if you just look at that and see that this has not come properly into the public domain, it must come before our law. If we pretend we live in a democracy.
Why on earth should Dr. Kelly, who knew so much about death, have attempted to commit suicide by just severing the smaller of the two arteries in one wrist? That is really quite astonishing. So I think for reasons such as that, and also the number of tablets that were taken, a big issue over how many tablets were taken, how many were ingested, the levels were not remarkable in the blood, they weren't lethal in the blood, that those matters should have been properly investigated.
So to silence him, I think, could very easily have appeared a necessary act at the time. And of course we must always remember too that people don't always behave totally rationally. One might say it was a silly action as well as wicked if it happened. But people don't, governments are not that wise always.
It's very striking that none of the police who gave evidence to Hutton were asked about those fingerprint searches. Therefore, they never had to say that the searches had been made and that they'd drawn a blank on every single score. You have to wonder why on earth this information didn't ever come out before. It only came out because several people made, myself included, a series of Freedom of Information requests to Thames Valley Police about that. One can only conclude that somebody somewhere took an active decision not to ask about the fingerprint searches which had been done. Highly irregular, very odd, very unusual, and it is one of the most striking questions which remains unanswered in the whole case.
Some experts agree that the coroner had a duty to conduct an inquest and that he has failed to do so. They accuse the government of facilitating malpractice and corruption at every level in this process. Dr. Watts and Spencer's executive summary, taken from their inquest application to the Attorney General, cites the contradictions and implausible nature of the government-approved version of events. At 9:15 a.m. on the 18th of July 2003, the body of Dr. Kelly was found with his head and shoulders against a tree. Around an hour later, the head was at some distance from the tree, sufficient for an ambulance man to stand between the tree and the head. We conclude that one or more third parties were present at the scene at Harrowden Hill and moved the body. We conclude that the likely purpose of moving the body was to create a false impression of suicide in order to conceal the murder of Dr. Kelly. We conclude that the suicide conclusion of the Hutton inquiry is unsafe and untrue. In the interest of justice, an inquest is required into the suspicious death of Dr. David Kelly. The death of Dr. David Kelly continues to haunt the political landscape. Strong public sentiments remain regarding both the Iraq War, how that war began, and the alleged assassination of Dr. David Kelly. This anger is what fuels the calls for a new inquiry.
I don't have a personal view as to exactly what occurred, but I do feel that we haven't yet had a proper exploration of all the facts, even the facts that are known, let alone those that haven't yet been brought to light. And I think there would be more to come to light if the proper people were interviewed.
The medical contradictions and improprieties did not receive the media attention revelations of this magnitude require. This possible self-censorship saw many journalists simply overlook the glaring inaccuracies of the government-approved story. In his report on the failure of the mainstream media, analyst Justin Schlossberg suggests that it was the adherence to a general consensus, a so-called safe zone of news, that led to journalistic blunders and oversights. Schlossberg's investigation also throws light onto the worrying trend by many corporate media outlets of simply accepting the official version of events without question or any form of adequate investigation.
There is very telling use of particular language and particular frames, both in the introductions and the conclusions to the report, that if you look closely at them, very much stray from the impartiality doctrine that television broadcasters tend to adopt in this country, and very much were strongly suggestive that any idea or that the campaign to reopen an inquest was based on false pretenses, that ultimately the official verdict was safe, that the government had opened the gates of secrecy and published all the documentary evidence which campaigners had demanded be published, which was completely factually inaccurate.
The war against Iraq, coupled with the desecration of the rule of law at home and the unsolved death of Dr. Kelly, has damaged the public trust in government to a great extent. The fact that numerous British governments have blocked an inquest into Dr. Kelly's death whilst imposing draconian laws to curtail freedom of speech and dissent points to a bleak and self-defeating strategy. Public interest in solving the case of Dr. Kelly has not abated in the years since his death.
I think it's sensitive. I think you have to make a distinction between those things that people are actually going to do something about and those things that simply bother people. And in that sense, it's the second category. It bothers people. It worries people. Remember that we had, for example, the largest demonstration in British history by a long way ahead of the Iraq War. We say in the anti-war movement, we say it was 2 million people. Nobody knows. But the point is that there are hundreds of thousands of people out there who did what they have never done before in their life, which is to march in the street.
This issue has actually, if anything, has grown in terms of capturing the attention of campaigners and of the news media themselves, who initially paid virtually no attention at all to the problems surrounding the official verdict of Kelly's death, as did the Hun report itself largely overlook that issue.
So when, for example, some news item comes up about David Kelly or some doctor's report on it or ambulance workers or whatever, then there is a definite level of interest. It's not some story that the media are just interested in. There's clearly the media interest corresponds to a public interest as well.
The Iraq Inquiry, chaired by Sir John Chilcot, was dismayed by many as a nonsensical bit of political theatre, toothless posturing which sought to examine Britain's role in Iraq. The inquiry had no legal authority or power to enforce any conclusions it may have reached, and some even went so far as to suggest it was merely a stage for former Prime Minister Tony Blair to regurgitate his line on the Iraq War.
And the truth in the end does come out, and however much it costs and however many years it takes, I believe the same will be true of the Iraq story and the attendant associated story of what happened to David Kelly.
Dr. Stephen Frost, one of the experts leading the call for a fresh inquest, stated that every medical student is taught that the coroner's duty is to speak for the dead to protect the living, and without coroners and inquests, nobody is safe.
I was taught that to lie was a cardinal sin. I hate lies. I love my country. And I do not want to see my country wallowing in lies which are never resolved. A catharsis is required, and Kelly will be part of that catharsis.
Many programmes have been made about the war in Iraq and the way the UK and the US justified it. The Iraq Inquiry is yet to officially release its report, so it may offer some closure. But it is nearly 9 years since Dr. Kelly died, and despite continuing interest in his death and vocal denouncements of the Hutton Inquiry, no further inquest or inquiry is planned. The suspicious death of Dr. Kelly still haunts many people, as they feel it is still unsolved. This is a case which is still open.
Now, we conclude the show with the following recording. This is from December 2013 from Tony Gosling's BCFM Weekly Politics show on Bristol Community Radio. The main speaker is Old Labour economist Martin Summers, and it is the most speculative of the contributions we have this week. I make no apology for that. I think it will work quite well as an antidote in case you're tempted to simplistic thinking about just why David Kelly might have been murdered by forces within the UK establishment.
One of the first people, if not the first person, to sign the Book of Condolence at the South African Embassy in Trafalgar Square was David Cameron. But it's interesting to see that he had a freebie trip to apartheid South Africa right at the height of the ban, really. I mean, he admitted his party had got it wrong, though, over sanctions when he later visited Mandela. David Cameron accepted an all-expenses-paid trip to apartheid South Africa while Nelson Mandela was still in prison. An updated biography of the Tory leader reveals today a trip by Mr. Cameron in 1989, when he was a rising star of the Conservative Research Department, was a chance for him to see for himself, and was funded by a firm that lobbied against the imposition of sanctions on the apartheid regime. Critics described it as a sanction-busting jolly that raised questions about the character of the man who, after a week when the government's credibility on the economy hit a new low — this is back in April 2009, was on course to be Prime Minister in little more than a year's time.
Yeah, that trip in 1989 is quite interesting because two other people were on that trip. One was Sir Kenneth Warren, who most people won't have heard of, but he's a rather important fundraiser for the Conservative Party and has been for many years, a sort of a money man. And the other third person on that trip was Dr. David Kelly. And the purpose of the trip was to go to Arms
Corps.
This
is the government scientist who died in 2003.
The very same one. So there were three people on this delegation: Dr. David Kelly, Sir Kenneth Warren, and David Cameron, who is a 20-something from Conservative Central Office. And information we've been receiving suggests that there was a deal being cooked up. South Africa had 9 nuclear weapons. They originally had 10 nuclear weapons, which they developed at Pelindaba with the Israelis. One of them was exploded over the South Atlantic. That left 9 nuclear weapons. It's like 10 green bottles, isn't it, this story? Anyway, as the changes were about to take place in South Africa, the Magnus Malan, who was the defence minister, Arms Corps, which was the their equivalent of BAE Systems, and they basically went to the West via an intermediary called John Bradenkamp, who was an ex-Rhodesian SAS operative, but was now actually a major arms dealer. People can look him up on the internet, and they will find him. He actually lives in Kilmersdown in Somerset now. But basically, they did a deal. They said, we don't want Nelson Mandela and the ANC to have these 9 nuclear warheads.
This is actually the white South African government saying that, well, since the country's going over to black majority rule, we think that they shouldn't have access to these secret nuclear weapons we've got.
Yeah, because otherwise Nelson Mandela would have got his finger on the nuclear button as soon as he won the election. That wasn't acceptable to the white South African elite, and it wasn't acceptable to the Western powers either. So they did a deal whereby these 9 nuclear warheads, which were uranium-based nuclear warheads, were sold to the Western powers, 6 to the Americans and 3 to the British. But what happened, the American warheads were loaded at Durban and taken to the US and dismantled. The 3 British warheads, and this is what the delegation, we suspect this delegation was about, they weren't sold to the British government directly. A private company called Astra Holdings, which was actually a subsidiary of Astra Fireworks, if people remember them, set up by a chap called Stephen Koch, who used to be an MI6 officer. They bought the 3 warheads, as it were, on the black market from Arms Corps, and then sold them on to the British government for £50 million. And Margaret Thatcher, one of the last things she did as she left office was sign a payment order for £50 million to Astra Holdings for these 3 warheads. But the warheads, of course, they had bought them from the South African government at much less than £50 million. And those who were involved in this scam got basically a profit from it, including the Conservative Party itself, which made £17.8 million to fund the 1992 general election.
Now, it's a pretty shocking accusation, Martin. Also, well, I've made it before. Find it, you know. People can find it online. It's an article by Peter Eyre. It's probably the best one to find. You can find EYRE on his own blog or on the Palestine Telegraph website about this whole story. But what evidence have you got for it?
Well, I'm getting evidence from people who were involved. So they're talking to me. I can't say who because they've signed the Official Secrets Act. But in any case, as you say, if people want to check this story for themselves, they can find it on Palestine Telegraph or Peter Ayres.
I mean, this 17 million donation, for example, is there any evidence for that?
Yes, there is. Doug Hoyle, the Labour MP, had been tipped off about this, and it's in Hansard. He made a question in the House of Commons. I can't remember what the year was. It was in the 1990s. Saying, well, where did this £17.8 million come from? And there was a sort of bluff, we can't possibly tell you, you'll have to look into it. But anyway, I mean, that's a lot of money. I mean, even in banker terms, £17.8 million is not peanuts, and in political terms, it's quite a large amount of money.
Yeah, certainly.
Plus, we could have made the difference between Major losing or winning the election, for example.
Well, certainly a fascinating twist to David Cameron's trip.
There's a further twist to the story, of course, which is that the warheads themselves then went missing. They lost them.
Well, how did they get the money for this 17 million then?
They went round Tory party donors and asked them to chip in to the pot, and then all of these people would then be paid back, and they were paid back. We've been given a list of people who actually made a lot of money. Makes my guns talk.
Previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download from our MP3 archive, unwelcomeguests.net/archive. If you've got a fast internet connection and you'd like to download a lot at once, you can try unwelcomeguests.net/downloads and download 100 episodes at a time. And if you're interested to explore further circumstances surrounding the death of David Kelly, I'd encourage you to do so at wikispooks.com. And if you broadcast this show, I would encourage you to join the low traffic mailing list at altruists.org/unwelcome. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. By unwelcome travelers and other brave men, they'll take the money and spread it out equal, just like the Bible and the prophets suggest. With men that go riding to help these poor workers, the rich will come down like an unwelcome guest.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next...
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. A conversation with Maggie and Arnie Gundersen. Friends in Inverness put them up in a cabin in the woods, just quarter mile from the famous San Andreas earthquake fault. Maggie and Arnie Gundersen came to California for a speaking tour at the end of 2015 and offered to meet me in the afternoon before giving a Fukushima update at the Point Reyes Dance Palace. I came down all the way from Mendocino, looking very much forward to meeting them in person. The Gundersens had become so familiar to me for the past 5 years with their fairwinds.org website and as a trusted source of information on the Fukushima disaster. Both worked in the nuclear industry, Maggie in public information, Arnie as an engineer and executive. I'm moved by people who question what they're doing, put in time and energy to reform an institution, have the courage to express their criticism, and in Arnie's case, risk their livelihood and excellent salary by becoming a whistleblower. Arnie was fired from Nuclear Energy Services in 1990. And as you will hear in a moment, Arnie and Maggie Gundersen are a close team in the nuclear education work they're now doing. They just recently decided to redefine the word nuclear accident and are coming up with a fascinating reframing. I started by asking them a question that had troubled me for a long time. Given that Arnie Gundersen is one of only a handful of whistleblowers, how early did people in the nuclear industry become aware that they were dealing with a monstrously dangerous technology? Here's Maggie Gundersen.
You asked how long we've known about this. I think the nuclear industry knew this from the very beginning. We're finding new papers, new things have been released, documents that show they totally hid things from the American people. Otherwise, these atomic reactors, because that's what they are, whether you change the name to nuclear reactors or nuclear power, they're atomic reactors and they're connected with the atom bomb. And you can't deny that at all.
We met when we worked on a nuclear plant together. And for the first 20 years of my career, I was senior vice president in the nuclear industry. I found some license violations at the company I worked for. So I told the president of the company this, and he fired me. I told the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and they deliberately botched the inspection, and they were taking bribes. So then Senator John Glenn, took interest in the case and fired up a special inspection. And the inspection found out that all the six items that I had brought forward and two others had indeed occurred. They found out that the guy who ran the inspection deliberately tried to suppress the information. This is the NRC manager, and that they were taking bribes. So that was 1990. So essentially the first 20 years of my career, I firmly believed in nuclear. But even after that, I believed in nuclear, but I just didn't think it was well regulated. I never really understood how the nuclear industry has co-opted the regulator. And we don't have effective regulation now. So it was Fukushima Daiichi that finally pushed me over. This is a technology that can wipe out a country overnight. Mikhail Gorbachev has said that the accident at Chernobyl was responsible for the collapse of communism. It wasn't perestroika. He actually blames the accident at Chernobyl for, you know, essentially destroying the Soviet Empire. And Naoto Kan, who was the prime minister of Japan at the time of the accident, said the same thing. He said that, you know, he looked at the possibility of evacuating 35 million people. How are you going to do that? Accident. We're working on this. We have. Yeah.
We're working on reframing, because there is no such thing as a nuclear accident. There are systems in place in which the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the industry assesses how much financial and physical damage and human damage an event in a nuclear plant would do. And so much money or so many people are disposable. That's a good word, disposable. I never knew that when I told people these plants were safe. I never knew that.
Is that the famous cost benefit?
Yes. They use probabilistic risk assessment, PRA. Roll a dice, see what happens, and the odds are. And that's not something you do with human lives or our planetary environment. We have only one Earth, and we can't make it inhabitable for all species.
The way the game is played at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is that they underestimate the probability of a disaster, and they also underestimate the cost to clean it up. So when you do that, of course, nuclear looks pretty darn good. But Fukushima Daiichi showed us that they're incredibly expensive to clean up. When it's over in Japan 100 years from now, they will have spent $500 billion cleaning up from those four reactors. So the price in dollars, let alone the human price, with 1 million cancers in Japan likely before this is all over, just way outweigh whatever benefits you're going to get. But it's our risk and the corporation's benefit. The corporations are making the profit, and we're taking the risk.
Yeah, in your report on the decommissioning of Vermont Yankee, I shouldn't be amazed to find that not only is it a private corporation, many people don't even know that your power is in private hands, but that this is a limited liability corporation. That is so astounding.
I never thought of the fact that nuclear power is in private hands when you have a limited liability corporation. But the nuclear industry has changed over the last 20 years such that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission allowed these plants to be given away to private industry for pennies on the dollar. Then private industry made an enormous amount of profit, but they never reinvested that profit back into the power plant. So you get debacles like Vermont Yankee and the leak, or worse yet, the tube failures at San Onofre. And all of those were caused because management was cheap and they didn't do it right. And they didn't want to get the public involved in the licensing process. So the net effect of this privatization of the nuclear industry is that when the plants run, the owners make a lot of money. When the plants break, the public's stuck with the public pain.
Yeah, this whole issue of giving them an enormous trust fund that ratepayers ponied up over time. Not only did they give away the plant for free, they said, here's your bank account.
And at every plant, there's not enough money put aside for decommissioning. Not one plant in the country has enough. So that means the public's going to be tapped again. And that if it's a utility, they're just going to add it on to costs for the ratepayers. And if it's one of the merchant plants like Vermont Yankee, where a corporation, an energy corporation, owns it, then they could just eventually, limited liability corporation, could walk away and leave what's left to be cleaned up by taxpayers. That Vermont, for example, is a little state. There's only There's not even 700,000 people in Vermont. So how are they going to afford? When we look at it now, it's as much as $1,000 per man, woman, and child in Vermont to pay for the extra costs.
There's many subsidies in the nuclear industry. The Price-Anderson risk insurance, where the public assumes the risk of a nuclear power plant blows up. But the hidden subsidy in the nuclear industry is decommissioning. What the Nuclear Regulatory Commission allows is that you don't have to dismantle a plant immediately. You're allowed to wait 60 years until you get enough money to decommission the plant. Well, in Vermont, we have to have a fully funded decommissioning fund when we build a windmill. But the Nuclear Regulatory Commission says Vermont Yankee can wait 60 years. I think a nuclear power plant is a little more dangerous than a windmill. You wouldn't allow a gas station to sit in your town with leaky tanks for 60 years. And yet the Nuclear Regulatory Commission looks the other way on nuclear power.
And here we're talking about a plant that hasn't blown up. Mm-hmm. Very often people say, oh, yeah, accident, you have to pay extra. But that's not true for just a normal plant that's shut down because of old age.
No, that's correct. None of the externalities, the things left outside of the realm of operations, are included in the costs either. For example, the mining and the mining cleanup, or all of the ongoing waste storage and where to put it and how to transport it and how to guard it from terrorism attack. None of that is calculated in any of the operations costs.
There was a uranium mine in Utah, at Moab, Utah. And the company that built the mine had this enormous dam loaded with all the junk that's left over from mining. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission told them they had to set aside $6 million to clean it up. That was the decommissioning fund required. And when they shut down, it turned out to be a $1 billion project. And the solution was they went bankrupt, and we, the citizens of the United States, got stuck cleaning up that mess. So when you hear about a nuclear power plant being cheap, the fuel is cheap, etc., it's because every accident and every mining disaster that they have are carried by the public, and only the successes get transmitted through in the cost of the fuel.
Taking into account what's being done with the waste, I mean, that's another supposedly subsidized program. Didn't the U.S. government take on responsibility to come up with a safe repository for the high-level waste?
Can we answer?
We'd answer it entirely differently. Go ahead, you start, and then I'll cut in.
When I get out of college, all the nuclear power plants in the country had fuel pools designed to hold 5 years of fuel. And the theory was that after 5 years, it would get shipped to a waste reprocessing facility and get turned right back around, and we'd make more fuel than we were using. It appeared to be endless, an endless cycle, a fuel cycle. In fact, it never was a fuel cycle. It was a fuel chain. It broke, and it starts and it ends, but it doesn't go round and round. So what's happened now is that we're storing all this nuclear waste in fuel pools, and as the fuel pools fill up, we're sticking it in dry cast storage. Now, in the 1980s and 1990s, the government stepped in and said, we'll take care of this nuclear waste. And they chose a spot in Nevada called Yucca Mountain. The reason they chose it has nothing to do with science, but it was because Nevada didn't have a lot of votes, and it was affectionately called the Screw Nevada Bill as it worked its way through the Senate and the House. And now Yucca Mountain's shut down because it doesn't seem to be technically correct, and politically it's unacceptable to the people who live in Nevada. And so we're stuck. We're storing all this waste above ground in dry cast storage for hundreds of years.
So Maggie, you have a different answer.
The technology simply does not exist. There is only one place in the world that believes that they have the technology, and that's in Finland. And they have dealt with building this huge underground bunker that has to hold the waste for 250,000 years, but they say they know it will only hold for 100,000 years. Plus, it's already filled, and they're still operating many, many more nuclear plants and producing much more waste. So they are only going to be able to store for 100,000 years a fraction of their waste. Any of the technologies developed anywhere else in the world don't work. The U.S. was counting on a form of encapsulation for some of its materials, and that doesn't work. Sweden did tests that show that it breaks apart in 100 years. This waste is the gift that keeps on giving. And when we haven't even had people, humans, species with language in that for that amount of time, how are we going to anticipate if the mines, salt mines, or the granite facilities like in Finland are marked in 10,000 years? How will people even know if that says that this is no trespassing? Will they have that same language? Will they write the same way? Or even worse, will another Hitler come along and want to take that material and use it to create bombs?
Some of that has to do with mixed oxide fuel. Mm-hmm. That was supposed to be a recycling.
Yeah, that's another
event. Another.
I'll cover that in a second.
Okay.
You know, there's 100 nuclear plants in the country, and before we ever figure a place to put it, we're going to have 100 dumps around the country where this spent nuclear fuel is going to be stored for as long as 100 years. The reprocessing of nuclear fuel is really done for bomb making. The plutonium that comes out of the reprocessing is a significant contributor to the making of atomic bombs. The Indians made their atomic bomb from reprocessed fuel. The Pakistanis made their atomic bomb from reprocessed fuel. North Koreans from reprocessed fuel. And the most frightening one is that Japan has enough plutonium now to make 1,000 nuclear warheads if they wanted to. So we've got the new regime there run by a man named Abe. He's the prime minister. And he wants to remilitarize Japan. And it's really frightening that their reprocessing program from commercial civilian nuclear plants is enough to make 1,000 nuclear bombs if they want to.
And just as concerning, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, is encouraging them to keep doing this reprocessing. The people of Japan don't want that plant to continue anymore. It's been operating for years and years and years and still doesn't work properly and keeps shutting down. And the Department of Energy is still encouraging them to do it as well. So we see it as part of a remilitarization that helps the Asia-Pacific plan by the U.S. government.
Actually, that's a fascinating comment because I wonder how much it has to do with global trade agreements and what's hidden behind them politically. Is this part of a strategy to isolate China?
Yeah.
I think that's true.
Yeah. You know, the Japanese have a unique perspective on nuclear power. The first bomb on Hiroshima was an enriched uranium bomb. So that uranium came out of the mine, ran through an enrichment facility, and then got dropped. The second bomb on Nagasaki was a plutonium bomb from reprocessed fuel from the Hanford reactors. So we had a plutonium bomb and a uranium bomb destroy two cities in Japan. Then about 10 years later, the Americans were testing a hydrogen bomb in the Pacific, and
100 miles away was a ship called the Lucky Dragon 5. And the hydrogen bomb was 10 times more explosive than scientists thought. It threw up a huge cloud of radiation, killed a couple of the crew members on the Lucky Dragon quickly, and the rest died horrible deaths over time. And the State Department was terrified that Japan would not be amenable to taking our nuclear ships into their harbors or into Okinawa. So the American State Department made a deal with the Japanese and said, we'll give you nuclear power plants because they're good, atoms for peace. And it took the Japanese mind off of the fact that they had civilians die in a hydrogen bomb, in a uranium bomb, and a plutonium bomb. And then, of course, 30 years after that, they had the Fukushima Daiichi disaster. So as a country, they've experienced the whole gamut of problems with nuclear power. It's the beginning, I'm afraid, of a remilitarization of Japan. And they certainly have enough plutonium to become a world power in nuclear if they chose to be.
Actually, that reminds me of meeting an employee of the Hiroshima City paper. His job was to seek out nuclear sites, bomb or mining or nuclear power sites, and report on them to keep alive this thought that Japan would do everything it could to not have a repeat of this, of its own fate. Mm. Have you ever come across the very few people who are left in Japan who see that as their mission?
We have, with one of our board members, Chiho Kaneko, has translated at the UN for the victims of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And she's worked extensively with some of them and has some real insight. And she did a beautiful blog post in Demystifying Nuclear Power, the blog on fairwinds.org on our website. And it brings you to tears to hear the stories. And she said, so much of this she never learned. They were never taught in school. And it's only in the last decade or so, as an international translator, that she's been able to learn this much about her country's own history.
You know, the bomb occurred in 1945, so 70 years have gone by. So it's only the very young people who are 20 years old or younger at Nagasaki and Hiroshima who are still alive to tell the story. We had one story where a young girl saw her father standing in line for medical treatment. And she went over and tugged on his sleeve, and it wasn't his sleeve. His entire skin rolled off his arm into her hand. He died shortly thereafter. I mean, this is a horrific way to destroy human beings. And I hope to heck it never gets tried again on this planet.
In a way, it brings us back to the issue that atomic nuclear power plants were really a result of bomb-making.
Mm-hmm. Right. Nuclear power plants are a result of bomb-making. They were the Atoms for Peace program, and the U.S. government tried to foster using them around the world. The technology was shared. Peaceful Atom was part of the Eisenhower program, even though President Eisenhower spoke against the militarization that we have now. And he said, never trust the military-industrial complex. And that is what we have, a military-industrial complex that uses the fuel to further bomb-making and to further the industries that support war around the world.
I'd love to ask you one more question.
Yeah.
The time at Fukushima, you probably will address it tonight, that it's even safe to approach it, much less to work on it, on a totally different scale than 60 years.
The Japanese claim that they want to completely dismantle and eliminate all the radiation from the Fukushima site in the next 40 years. That's not going to happen. I was an executive in decommissioning of nuclear power plants. And when they're clean, it takes 10 or 20 years. And this site is anything but clean. The radiation levels are so high that not only will they kill a person, but they fry the electronics on the robots as they go into these areas. I also think it's terrible for the young Japanese men who will be working on the decommissioning, because the regime, the current regime, wants to do it quickly. They really want to do it quickly to show the Japanese population that nuclear's safe, that we can get this done, we can get it behind us and move on. In fact, they're going to overexpose a generation of young Japanese men if they do that. My attitude is what the Russians did in the Ukraine on Chernobyl. Build a cover over it, let it sit for 100 years or more, and then go in. 100 years, the radiation exposures will be 10 or 15 times lower. So it's a good thing to wait if you're really concerned about the Japanese gene pool and the genetic damage to the workers that this massive cleanup will entail. On top of that, it's going to be $500 billion to clean it up. It's a mind-boggling amount of money. And the Japanese government doesn't want to admit that to its people because they'll turn against nuclear. There's too much money in the process, and Japanese banks have bankrolled these 50 plants that are presently shut down. They want their money back. And the Japanese government is going to make sure that happens by turning these power plants back on.
This was a conversation with Maggie and Arnie Gundersen. I visited them in their guest cabin in Inverness, West Marin, just before their Fukushima update presentation in Point Reyes Station, California. The date was November 21, 2015. As I'm producing this program on the fifth anniversary of the Fukushima disaster in March 2016, Arnie Gundersen is spending a month in Japan to assess the status of the cleanup. He writes reports and calls in updates from his tour. Even though polls show that at least 70% of Japanese do not want the nuclear power plants reopened that were shut down 5 years ago, the Abe government is determined to put many of them back online and has begun the process. Visit their website, fairwinds.org, for videos and podcasts, as well as blog posts on current events, expert witness reports on nuclear safety issues, a book list, media coverage, and much more. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Groundwire, community radio news, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This episode of Groundwire is produced on traditional Mi'kmaq territory in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and I'm your host, Matt Willish.
This is a special edition of Groundwire, produced for the 14th Annual Homelessness Marathon. The marathon is a collaborative project between National Campus and community radio stations in Canada and its supporters. During the 14-hour marathon, dozens of stations participate in producing content that comes in from volunteers, staff, community groups, and everyday folk. The broadcast is being aired on 22 stations across the country, and we at Groundwire are glad to be a part. Coming up...
We have privatized many public spaces, so business improvement districts and, you know, just enclosing places.
I'm trying to better understand homelessness through the perspective of adult daughters of men living on the streets.
But first, here are the headlines. The Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, or OCAP, released a new report mid-February. Titled Out in the Cold, The Crisis in Toronto's Shelter System, the report highlights how dire the situation in Toronto really is. The situation is all the more pressing, given the recent announcement that the city is considering cutting funding to its 24-hour warming centers. The report draws from first-hand accounts and first-hand evidence and aims to challenge the ongoing assault on the health and dignity of those who access the shelter system. The report recommends that new space be made available and that the city policy keeps its shelter occupancy at a maximum of 90%. The report also affords a rare glimpse into the night-by-night struggles of hardworking people desperate to fill the gaps left by an overcrowded, underfunded shelter system. It takes a huge toll on both the program's volunteer staff and the service users lost in the cracks. The report was publicly launched at a rally organized by OCAP on Wednesday, February 17th. Supporters gathered at Queen and Sherbourne Street and marched to Toronto City Hall, demanding that no one be left out in the cold. Demonstrators entered City Hall Council chambers chanting,
"Shelters, not guns! Shelters, not guns! Shelters, not guns! No more homeless deaths! No more homeless deaths!"
To read the report Out in the Cold, The Crisis in Toronto Shelter System, by the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, visit ocap.ca.
After years of waiting, Canada's first dedicated queer youth shelter is set to open in February in Toronto's Annex neighbourhood. The shelter will be run by the YMCA and is one of two queer-oriented youth shelter programs that Toronto City Council approved funding for in early 2015. Researchers have estimated that anywhere between 25 to 40% of homeless youth in Toronto identify as queer. Often subjected to hate and violence, queer youth avoid shelters for fear of being attacked because of their sexual identity. The YMCA will start filling up the 25 available beds in February and is looking to have them all occupied by mid-March. The shelter is open to youth between the ages of 16 and 24, and in addition to transitional housing, the shelter will also provide services similar to other shelters, such as life skills development. But other aspects will be geared specifically towards queer youth, like community outings that celebrate queer identities. The support and excitement for the project has been overwhelming in Toronto, and though it is a great first step, there are also still concerns, especially for trans youth. One organizer said that trans youth are the most marginalized, and specifically trans women of color, who experience not only racism from within their own community, but also suffer from police harassment. This year alone, four trans women of color have died. Groundwire will keep listeners informed about this new initiative in Toronto, and surely its expansion around the country.
The Yonge Street Mission in Toronto is moving to Chinatown, but is getting an unwelcome response from the community. CJRU The Scope brings us this headline.
The move has created controversy with some Chinatown business owners. Sally Ritchie, manager of marketing and communication for the Yonge Street Mission, joins us now via telephone to tell us more.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
My pleasure.
Since announcing the move, there's been a lot of apprehension from the community. How would you describe it?
I wouldn't say from the community. I'd say from one specific part of the community. It's the Chinatown BIA that has expressed concerns. And we have been working with them as well as with other stakeholders to address those concerns because we do actually want to hear from people to hear what they're worried about so that ahead of time we can work together to solve the problems. From the very beginning, we have been meeting with the BIA's, Residents Associations, from Councillor Joe Cressy, who's the ward councillor, and he's been incredibly supportive. We've also been meeting with the police and other social agencies in the area in order to determine what the needs are.
That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this.
I'll play two of them. The first one is called The Baguette.
Okay.
Thank you.
You wrote that. That's fantastic.
You just heard audio from a 2014 video featuring Ryan Arcand, an Edmonton homeless man. The video was part of a project to get Edmonton homeless people more involved with the arts. The video has since been viewed nearly 8 million times. Next up is our feature story. Kayla Ortwine, a graduate student in communications and culture at the University of Calgary, has focused her research on the daughters of homeless fathers. She explains that her own experience of growing up with a transient father inspired her to reach out to other daughters, and the entire process has shifted how she thinks about homelessness. Sarah Rao from CJSW brings us this report.
I'm trying to better understand homelessness through the perspective of adult daughters of men living on the streets. For the last 6 or 7 years of his life, my dad was homeless. It was a really challenging position for both of us, particularly in how we maintained a relationship.
She explains why a focus on the families of unhoused individuals is a necessary one.
A lot of the literature suggests that for somebody who's homeless, a lot of things that they talk about are their children. And so sometimes the only thing getting them through the next day is the fact that they have children and they want to be as best of a person as they can be for them or get better because of them or, you know, all different types of things or just, you know, work harder so that they get to see them again or be in contact again. And I think that's something that's really important in terms of just finding new positive reinforcements for somebody going through such a traumatic and hard time. And if that is with their children, then there should be some support system or social structure in some way that provides that link to kind of maintain those relationships where just on your own, it's difficult because it's hard to understand each other. And so if there was some sort of, you know, medium to really establish that connection and or reestablish that connection, I think that would be really vital.
This new focus, she says, offers a different perspective into how people become homeless.
There's no cookie-cutter explanation as to how this happens. The women who I've interviewed or spoken to so far who have shared a bit of their experience, they're all from different socioeconomic classes. Their fathers have all had different professions. You know, some had mental illness, some hadn't. Some had addictions problems, some hadn't. Some chose this, some hadn't. So there really is no one explanation, and I think that's really important in terms of breaking down stereotypical assumptions of why somebody's on the street, especially in terms of that undeserving poor idea. The undeserving poor are the people who are seemingly at fault for their own homelessness. These are the people who, you know, they might be doing drugs or they might be alcoholics or they might have lost their job for whatever reasons. These types of people are often men, and they're often on the streets. And in this way, they're very vulnerable in terms of the types of compassion that they're receiving from, you know, different types of people who pass by or, you know, within shelters or those types of things.
There are currently no support systems for the families of homeless individuals.
I've heard from a couple homeless shelters in Calgary who are interested in talking to me and just trying to get a better perspective in terms of what it's like as a family member and how they can better help us as well, because that's really important. At least for myself, there was never any sort of inclination to, you know, provide support for me or help us through this. And maybe that's just selfish of me, but I think it could have really benefited me. It was fine, but I think maybe for future children going through this, it would be nice to have a little bit more of a support system. Even just knowing that other people experience this, I had never met anybody in the same situation until I started this project.
Once she completes her thesis project, Kayla Ortwine plans to write a book about her experience to encourage policy changes to support families of unhoused individuals.
I think people are reconsidering how they treat homelessness, at least that's my hope, and get a better idea of the type of experiences that go along with homelessness. It's not just somebody on the street. They have a family and they have a life story, and those are different types of things that we consider for other people, but I don't think they're often considered for, you know, the people who are on the street.
This has been Sarah Rowe at CJSW in Calgary, reporting for Groundwire.
Our next feature comes to us from CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Produced by Emily Rendell Watson, here's a segment from CKDU's contribution to the Homelessness Marathon.
Metro Nonprofit Housing Association is an organization that helps people get off the street and into affordable housing. They have 86 units across North End Halifax and Dartmouth for people with housing insecurities. The association also realizes how important it is for people to stay connected with one another. Since 1996, it's hosted a drop-in center for people to sit and chat over a cup of coffee. The drop-in is also a spot for people to practice their singing with the Shining Lights Choir. Frances Tessie Burns went to the center to see how a cup of coffee and music brings people together.
The Housing Support Center on Gottingen Street is a popular spot for people who need a warm cup of coffee to start their day. Nicknamed the Coffee Shop, it's run by the Metro Nonprofit Housing Association. Walking through the front door, there are two rooms full of people chatting about their day and sipping their coffee. Adam Kraft is the center's coordinator.
The drop-in started in 1996 as a response to needs that were outlined by various committees. They basically identified that part of the struggle with maintaining housing is the lack of places to socialize when you're living in poverty.
The drop-in is open every Monday to Thursday from 8 a.m. to noon. On the right, there are shelves full of books and teddy bears. On the left, pictures of people who have come through the coffee shop over the years. Kraft says they see about 100 people on a regular day and serve more than double that in cups of coffee.
So the primary focus is that sort of community space. A lot of folks are facing stigmatization because of addictions and mental health issues, and sometimes addictions and mental health combined. Also physical disabilities even.
With so many people coming through the door, it's not always easy to keep the peace. There's even a sign above the door that warns people, be nice or leave. But no one is ever banned. The community only gets stronger, and it never shows more than on Thursdays at noon at choir practice.
So guys, you want to try Country Roads?
Sure. Yeah.
With the Nova Scotia lyrics, right?
Yeah.
After moving some tables and chairs, people settle in to start singing. The Shining Lights Choir started in 1997. Brian Anderson was the drop-in's coordinator at the time. After hearing about a homeless men's choir in Montreal, Anderson and others from the drop-in decided to bring the idea to Halifax. Amy Moonshadow is one of the few remaining original members. She remembers Anderson and the early days of the choir.
His peers, his co-workers of the other agencies in the North End said, they'll come a couple of times because you give them a treat, but it won't last. And now, like, you get a full house of people coming to practices every week.
And they love to sing. Over the years, Moonshadow has seen how the choir affects people.
People who have, been lost in their own little shell and berry, who have, gained a lot of confidence and, actually pretty talented in their own right and have, And so, I've seen, just what the choir can do for people's self-esteem.
Vladimir Sitnikov is the choir's new director. He jumped in headfirst in early December and started doing Christmas concerts. Now into the new year, the choir has been positive for both the director and the singers.
It's pretty rewarding to be with people who truly enjoy what they do, and I guess in a way helping people, sharing what they can.
Sitnikov's got big plans for the choir. He's working with them towards recording an album later this year. It'll be the choir's fourth album. Moonshadow says one of the best parts is the concerts they get to put on around the province.
It's wild and wonderful when we go on these road trips. Because, not everybody grew up in the same manner, so it's interesting, especially when we go to, fancy churches and, people who have never been to church keeping track of when to sit up and when to stand and what to do. It's good fun. But whoever invites us are always so welcoming and so generous that it's a real community builder.
So why is music such a great tool? Sitnikov says it brings people together.
It's a creation, it's an art. Doing this through music is also lots of fun, right? So we choose songs all together, we choose songs that all these guys like, right? So we put them together, we rehearse, so everybody enjoys this.
For Kraft, music brings us back to a more innocent time.
I personally think that it's something that people connect with when they're kids. It gives them that kind of freedom to sing, freedom to sing with other people. So I think that connection to something bigger than the individual is what draws people back.
It's been nearly 20 years since the Shining Lights Choir began. Since then, Moonshadow has seen a double in size, bringing in about a dozen people every week.
There's a lot of bang for your buck in this little space. That, you know, there's so much that happens here that goes unnoticed, but it builds community.
More people with more voices that deserve to be heard. Frances Tessier Burns, CKDU, Halifax.
How can I say I'm sorry? How can I say I'm sorry? Keep an eye out, look for me. Keep an eye out, look for me.
You just heard Somewhere by Montreal-based The Painters. The Homelessness Marathon down south in the U.S. aired for its 18th year, titled Giving Homeless People a Voice in the Choice. The broadcast was a mix of live-to-air coverage alongside pre-produced segments from across the U.S. The live-to-air portion was broadcast from Washington, D.C., outside the White House, where the homeless, broadcasters, and supporters walked around the White House talking with the homeless people there. They also conducted the first ever homeless primary, where homeless people around the country were asked their choice for president, with the results being announced at the end of the 14-hour broadcast. We start our community radio report in conversation with Jeremy Alderson, the founder of the Homelessness Marathon broadcast. Then we will bring you some highlights from the 18th annual Homelessness Marathon in the U.S.
Well, I founded the Homelessness Marathon in 1998. I did the first one in Ithaca, New York. And just kind of put myself out there. And I had some extra time, and I wanted to devote it to something that was local that I really cared about. So I did that, and I didn't ever think I would do it twice. But after the broadcast, you know, not very many people even heard it, but the people who heard it seemed to be very motivated by it. And I could see that they had really gotten it. You know, it was like kind of like a hit in a way, that it had reached people, and not everything you do does. So that was why I decided to put it up on the satellite and see if other stations were interested in it for the second year, and it just grew after that. And then I decided to make it a national event, And that eventually spawned the Canadian Homelessness Marathon. Well, okay, it's gone up and down. It was at its peak at 140 or so affiliates. This year we ran with something a little over 90, I think. But I want to say that it's meant a lot to me through the years that the Canadian Marathon has existed. It's been a wonderful thing to think that it spread in some way and that people took to the concept and made it their own and were able to find something in it to do. It's just wonderful.
Welcome to the 18th Annual Homelessness Marathon, a national dialogue on homelessness and poverty in America. We'll continue our homeless walk around the White House with a visit to Franklin Park, where dozens of homeless people pitch tents. They're all slated to be fenced out soon, but not as part of D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser's pledge to eliminate all homeless camps in the city. No, the park needs renovations. Then we'll go to Philadelphia for a talk with Sherry Honkola, head of the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign, right after this.
People don't usually plan to experience homelessness. Life just takes unexpected turns. But for some guests of the Brother Francis Shelter in Anchorage, like Mike Hindman, the experience leaves them with more hope than anything else. When I spent the night at the shelter late last month, he greeted me and other guests at the door.
All right, anybody and everybody who walks inside, please come in line up on the right-hand side. How you doing?
It was an unusually calm summer evening. 26-year-old Michael Hindman was monitoring the entrance area to the shelter and checking for contraband like weapons or alcohol.
Anything inside your pockets I can see real quick?
Burly and tall with a goofy smile, the name of an ex-girlfriend tattooed in delicate script on his arm, Hindman never saw himself in a place like Brother Francis. He was young, strong, making good money.
In the back of my mind, I thought, you know, like, why are people homeless? Like, I've always had a job. Why don't people work? And why don't people do this? And, you know, maybe I didn't have compassion or sympathy at first.
And then he made a mistake.
This is the part of the story where I got to tell the truth, okay? This is my big blip. I was in Dutch Harbor, Alaska, working as a longshoreman.
Hindman got involved with drugs. He was busted for buying narcotics for an undercover cop. He pleaded guilty to a felony and went to prison.
I learned my lesson right off the bat. My first 30 minutes in jail, I realized this is not for me. And then besides that 30 minutes, I had another 18 months to learn the same lesson, thinking, this is definitely not for me, you know.
As part of the plea deal, he gave the state everything he owned. He was released this spring in Anchorage, a town he had never visited and where he had no friends. He walked out with nothing but purple prison underwear, donated clothing, and a quarter in his pocket. After sleeping rough for a couple nights, someone told Hindman about Brother Francis. He began volunteering as a door monitor in exchange for secure housing at the shelter and help finding a job.
Thank you. And if you're just joining us, again, this is the 18th Annual Homeless Marathon. And I wanted to, if Eric is there, I want to bring you back into the conversation. But as we close out, we have about 8 minutes left. I just wanted to talk about the use of private security guards, private police. We've seen them in other facets of society. How are they being used to harass the homeless, to guard the homeless? Can anyone speak to that?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I think as everybody has been talking about, it is it all is interconnected. That we have privatized many public spaces, so business improvement districts, and you know, just enclosing places, public squares, malls, turning it over to private development. In some cities, the police are allowing businesses to basically give police unfettered, advanced ability to arrest people who are simply in front of businesses on public sidewalks. Our public goods, as Paul and Christy were saying, are being sold off. Our public housing, our public assets. And it's being replaced by, something that says, this is mine.
Brenda from Maryland, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon.
My name is Brenda, and I'm calling from Maryland. And there's a lot that can be said. I'm an RN on top of that, but I also have been homeless. I know what it or what they call home. In other words, I'm an individual that have experienced not having a home. And what is sad is that it's bad for anyone. I'm calling because of someone, a veteran, who I used to see up under the bridge here where I lived at. And I was, moved, I became concerned. And, I would always speak. A lot of people would drop money in the bucket. But I knew that that in itself is not going to solve the problem, because if money in itself solved all the problems, we wouldn't have this problem.
We're down to our last minute. So there's not really much more to say, except people, homeless people. Remember, when you hear the term homeless people, the operative word is people. People. They don't cease to become people when they're homeless. So we want to see this problem solved. We want to see it solved. Hey, when do we want to see it solved?
Now.
Right on. Right on, brothers and sisters. So I want to thank everybody for listening. I want to thank all of our affiliated stations. And like I say, if you don't believe in miracles, you're not a realist. Thank you for listening. Everybody, see you next year.